Today on BPR, what a week ahead. Kushner, Manafort, and Trump Jr. all talk on Capitol Hill. And back home, a mayoral election nears. The Globe's Josh Miller and former Globe Joanna Weiss join us. Then it's Sean Spicer, we hardly knew ye. Will you miss him? And is there a larger message somewhere in there? Then at noon, it's Homeland Security expert Julia Kayyem. We'll talk about D.C. and San Antonio, where 9 undocumented immigrants are dead in the back of a tractor trailer.
I'm Andrea Cabral, in for Marjorie Egan. When it comes to a teenager's behavior, the common refrain is, what were you thinking? But maybe it's more, what weren't you thinking? In her latest book, neuroscientist Frances Jensen looks at the teenage brain, which she says is still a work in progress. From there, we asked TV authority Bob Thompson, what was HBO thinking when they greenlighted the TV series Confederate? That's coming up on Boston Public Radio.
Listening to Boston Public Radio, I am Jim Browdy. Marjorie is off for just a few more days, sitting in today and the next couple of days as former sheriff of Suffolk County, former secretary of public safety. That would be Andrea Cabral. Hi, Andrea.
Hello.
You know, last week, 3 days, Shirley Leung and I did the show. We got along very well. I think it's fair to say our relationship's a little more contentious, is it not?
No. On the contrary. I adore you. You're a lovely man with many fine qualities.
It's going to be really testy. We'll see if we make it through the next couple of days, next few hours. In any case, in the interim, it's great to have you here, Andrea.
Thank you very much.
And by the way, your BPR weekend thing, I listened again yesterday, is really, really good.
Congratulations to you and Marcella Garcia and I are having a good time.
In any case, in the spirit of Made in America Week, it looks like President Trump is working to do the same for our elections, signaling that he will sign new legislation imposing sanctions on Russia, or will he? His new communications team is already sending mixed messages on sanctions and on pardons. Here with us in Studio 3 to take on these and other political headlines is reporter Josh Miller. Josh covers politics for the Boston Globe, and he's the man behind the Globe's Political Happy Hour, which I love. You can get it free in your email if you sign up. He'll tell us how. We're also joined by journalist Joanna Weiss. Joanna, Josh, it's great to see you both.
Hello.
Nice to be here.
Hi, Joanna. Hi, Josh. We're going to get to the sanctions in a second, but as of 8:49 this morning.
It was. Timestamp it.
That's late for him.
That is kind of late. It usually starts at 3 in the morning and could go pretty smoothly up until about 6.
He slept
in. But no, 8:49, he was inspired, apparently, and the president has tweeted. I'll just read the tweet for you because, as you know, the dear departed Sean Spicer used to say, the tweets speak for themselves. Here's what he tweeted. So why aren't the committees and the investigators, and of course our beleaguered AG, looking into crooked Hillary's crimes and Russia relations? And there is no apostrophe between, you know, the S in the Y in Hillary. Hillary's the possessive. So that's his latest tweet. And he refers to his own AG as the beleaguered AG. What do you think
about
that?
Yeah, I wonder why his AG is so beleaguered.
Well, you know what Andrea said to me this morning.
How can he refer to him as beleaguered when he's the one who beleaguered
him? Right. No, I mean, look, good luck to his new communication staff, because there is no controlling this guy, and there's no controlling his ability to step in the way of his own message on every possible opportunity. Week by week, he probably has something that he could point to that would at least please his base and that might, you know, make it look like he's accomplishing something. And he starts off almost every week or ends every week with this crazy tweet.
But Josh, maybe what would please his base, to use Joanna's words, are Jeff Sessions resigns. I mean, the question was, after the New York Times interview last week, where I would argue pretty much humiliated Sessions, he's humiliating him yet again this morning. Is the end game get out of here so I can have a new person just like I have in communications?
I think so, but the question is, does Jeff Sessions want to leave? He had a good career as a U.S. senator, and he had this sort of awesome new responsibility of being the chief law enforcement official of the United States of America. And from what I've read and heard, he's enjoyed it quite a lot.
Yeah, but you work for a guy who obviously doesn't trust you. And I would assume if you work for Jeff Sessions, you say to yourself, well, I don't know where my loyalty should be. The big boss can't stand my guy. So he's between the proverbial rock and a hard place, he being Sessions, is he not?
It's true. But as New York Times political reporter Maggie Haberman tweeted this morning, someone needs to tell the president of the United States there's swifter ways to remove people you don't like, such as firing them. And President Trump does have that ability to say, you know, Attorney General Sessions, thanks for your 6 months. Why don't you go spend some more time with your family? You can, you know.
But he can't. I mean, this is just my opinion. I think that's difficult for him, because if he fires him, you have to have a reason for firing your AG. he's already made it clear that the reason that he lost confidence in his AG is that the AG didn't help provide cover on the Russia investigation.
No, wait. He can fire him for the same reason he fired Comey, because he was mean to Hillary Clinton. That's why. Just get that over with, right?
Yeah, that's actually a good one to drag out. But I think that's, if him resigning, I think, helps Trump more. And I think bullying him into resigning is more palatable to Trump than the firing, which can be evidence of further obstruction.
As much as we know that Trump used to like to say, you're fired, I think you're right. And I mean, it's such a tricky, or it's such a, I don't know if it's a sad situation for Jeff Sessions. I feel the same way for about Sean Spicer, that these guys knew what they were getting into. I mean, there's no mystery about the kind of person that you're going to work for when you take an appointment like this, even if it is your dream job. And yet, look at, you know, the loyalty and the questionable effects on his reputation that Jeff Sessions willingly put up with in order to have this job was for naught. He's going to walk away with his reputation tattered in every direction.
And so still, what is exposure for perjury?
So what is that, the message of those essentially attempting to push Sessions out, or at least humiliate him 2 times in 4 days? Firing, or essentially pushing Sean Spicer out, who, to say he's been loyal, I'd say, is an understatement. Does that not send a message to everybody who's still there as to how loyal you should? You're shaking your head like your head's about to come off there, Joanna.
Yes, yeah, it's pivoting on its axis here. No, I mean, saying yes, everyone is sort of on notice. I mean, I don't know what, Paul Ryan, again, made a whole calculation because he wants to advance an agenda. Mitch McConnell made a calculation to support the president, to advance an agenda. Everyone who's working for him has to be thinking, am I next? You know, what do I do?
And is that who knows? We don't know this guy. The only one on Matt Visor, your colleague, actually talks to the guy from time to time. I guess less so now, meaning Donald Trump. How do you achieve? Is that maybe in the private sector, when you're running a $1 billion corporation, that's a good strategy. Everybody on their heels. They're all fungible. Everybody's replaceable. I don't see how this helps Donald Trump. Can you explain to me how it might, Josh?
I cannot explain.
Okay, let me try this. Let me try. I think it's even worse, because we're going to talk to listeners in about a half hour about the Spicer thing. What's more significant to me than the crowding out of Sean Spicer with Scaramucci coming in and Spicer resigning is not that, but when you read the stories that not only did Spicer not know anything about it on the day that it was happening, but Reince Priebus, the chief of staff, and Steve Bannon, you know, the Darth Vader, as they call him on Saturday Night Live, behind this, not only didn't know about it in the morning, but opposed his elevation. The basic message is, I don't listen to any of you about anything. I want this guy to be my new confidant, Scaramucci, and screw all of you. Isn't that the clear message from the whole communications department thing?
That is the clear message, and he might not get pushback from within the White House, because in the end he has the final say on that. But say Sessions ends up resigning today, tomorrow, next week, next month, he'll have to find a replacement. Axios, the Washington, D.C. news outlet, reported this morning that some insiders in the West Wing were floating the name of former New York City Mayor Rudy Giuliani to be the next attorney general. But the question there is...
Why'd you laugh there, Josh?
The next attorney general. But the question there is, will he be able to get someone like that through the Senate? Because it's unlike choosing a new press secretary. There is an advice and consent aspect that the Constitution puts in place. And I don't know whether Rudy Giuliani could get 50 votes in the United States Senate, even with Republicans in control.
I'm sure you're a big fan, Andrea, of Giuliani's.
I would love nothing better than for Rudy Giuliani, for him to nominate Rudy Giuliani.
Why is that?
To me, that's like the cherry on top of a sundae not made of ice cream. No, he can't get through the Senate because the Republicans in the Senate are really interested in going after leakers. And doesn't Rudy Giuliani have a leaking problem with the FBI and all of the stuff that he told us leading up to the election about something's coming in about 24 hours with Hillary Clinton? He couldn't make it through anyway. If they dredged up what happened when he was mayor of New York City, he couldn't make it through. But certainly since that time, I don't think he could make it through. But I would like to see Donald Trump nominate him just for the sheer pleasure of watching him go through that confirmation hearing. But to Jim's point about Sean Spicer and to your point, Joanne, about everything, everybody who works for him, they do go in it with their eyes wide open and they do know what they're getting into. But
no, they don't. Have you ever worked in Washington, any of you three? I have. I was a lobbyist. And I really use the term loosely in Congress. The sycophancy is everybody's goal is to make it to the White House. You have somebody of your own party, and I know Donald Trump is aberrational, but I think all common sense, with some exceptions, disappears, and you say, I'm going to be the press secretary, the president of the United States. He'll listen to me.
I think there was collective wishful thinking on the part of not just people who wanted to work for Trump, but everyone in the Republican Party and probably people beyond. This idea that people are still grappling with, that Trump is a rational actor and that once he got into the job, he would behave like any other rational actor.
And I'm the one who can convince him in my area. What?
But that hasn't happened.
Of course it hasn't.
And it was apparent that it wasn't going to happen from the day that Sean Spicer took the podium and said, who are you going to believe, my president or your lying eyes, as to the size of his inauguration crowds? I mean, there can't be any, even if they didn't go in with their eyes wide open, I'll give you this, Jim. People come in breathless. They want to work.
Yeah.
But 2 weeks in is really all you need. He couldn't hire lawyers from the top law firms. Why? They said he's the worst client you can have. He doesn't listen to you. He doesn't take your advice, and he won't keep his mouth shut. What else do you need?
Roy Cohn was unavailable, so he couldn't. Exactly.
But
we're talking to Joanna
happening.
Weiss and Josh Miller. So can we talk about, there's so many things. It's unbelievable. Jared, as if he's my buddy. Jared Kushner, the son-in-law and secretary of everything, goes behind closed doors, says, I didn't collude this morning, apparently. That was his written statement of
advance. But not under oath.
Was it not under oath?
Not under oath.
Oh, that's
it's
huge.
Still a crime.
I didn't know
it's
that.
Still a crime to lie to Congress, but this
it
isn't under oath. Yes, it is.
And the biggest disappointment, I would say, of the month is that Donald Jr. and Paul Manafort, the former chair, will not be testifying in public, at least on Wednesday. But this is a huge week in terms of Congress showing that they're big enough to handle this Russia mess. Is it not, Josh?
It's a huge week in terms of them gathering new testimony, I think. History will show, the future will show, and historians looking
how
back
big it
will
was,
show
right.
whether how big this particular week was and whether Congress was up to the challenge of looking into this. I think probably Bob Mueller will be the larger character or whoever his successor is, if indeed there is a successor, will be the larger character in this.
You've been looking at Joanna's face for this whole discussion, the whole 15 minutes. Why now, Joanna?
Oh,
what are you
no,
thinking?
Just my eyes are going to pop out of my head. Every week is a new crazy week. No, I mean, you know, it's like it really is laid out on a silver platter for Congress at this point to show some cojones, to take control of the situation. How many people now were present at this meeting in question?
It's eight so far.
She actually referred to it as an auditorium of Russians.
Is that what he said? Oh, that's a great line, actually.
Said,
that's pretty
good. It went
good.
From one, two people, three people to an auditorium of Russians.
There's so much to pick apart. There is so much opportunity for people to assert some independence from this administration. But again, you know, you get back to the rules of Washington, I think. I agree with Josh. It's really an open question. What's going to happen?
You know, the one open question that I cannot believe, Juliette Kayyem is going to be standing where you are, Josh, in about 40 minutes, said about a month ago, the pardons are about to start coming. And Marjorie and I both laughed at her saying, don't be ridiculous. They're not even going to talk about pardons. Now Trump's tweeting that he has the power to pardon everybody. We're having debates in the newspaper. Can he pardon himself? Can he not pardon himself? Everybody, he does clearly have the power to pardon everybody other than himself, and that's the debate. Could he possibly survive the pardoning of his son, his son-in-law? These things politically? I mean, we've been wrong. Most of us have been wrong in every instance in the past, but it seems to me this would be just epic, and even the Republicans would say this is a bridge too far, Mr. President.
Maybe. I'm bullish on the ability of the American idea and the Constitution and the elasticity of our norms of constitutional democratic government to last. I don't know whether that also includes Republicans, you know, saying this is a bridge too far. I'm not sure if it would.
So here's what I mean. I think government lasts, and I think ultimately Trump is a singularity and kind of an aberration.
Singularity.
He's a singularity. But I also do not I don't think he's going anywhere. I don't think he has any interest in going anywhere. That's wishful thinking. And I think because his base is consuming an entirely different media from what I think a lot of us around the table are consuming and is consuming an entirely different narrative, he has not lost a lot of support from his absolute core supporters.
Did you say, I'm going to get the number
only
wrong.
36% of the country. And what I don't understand is why we are focusing on this third of the country as though they are the majority of the country.
Because
all, every day
primaries.
We care about what Trump voters think. Every day there's a story about how they're still not leaving him. Who cares? Two-thirds of the country wants something done about this.
Well, if I were Donald Trump, to that I would say, who cares? I'm here for exactly 3 years, 5 months, and 29 more days,
I don't care what the polls say. I'm saying I don't expect him to care, but I do expect media to get off this narrative. I mean, especially when you look at the fact that, 95% of black women didn't vote for Bernie Sanders and didn't vote for Trump. If that percentage of any other population voted a certain way, there would be at least one story on why that happened. How come they didn't buy the nonsense that either one of these people were selling? We don't get that. We get the Trump supporter who still, no matter what he says or does, supports him, and we get stories.
Well, I'm going to get
that.
You even more aggravated because my favorite story of the weekend, and it's pretty hard, is I'm going to get the number a little off, but maybe one of you guys knows. There was a poll of Trump supporters, and they were asked about the Donald Trump Jr. meeting, and somewhere in the neighborhood of 20 to 30% of Trump supporters say the meeting never happened,
right,
even though Donald Trump Jr. sends out the emails showing it did happen.
Yeah.
Meaning the point is there's nothing about this president that we will not defend him on that 36%. You know, can we spend a couple of minutes here? I don't know if we should spend any time on the sanction issue. The Congress overwhelmingly is going to pass the Russian sanctions. Some reports, including one in the Globe, says, well, it's likely he's going to sign it, even though it limits his own power. Others are suggesting he might not. The thing that it seems to me is worth talking about, though, if you want to talk about it, that's fine. Obamacare, allegedly Mitch McConnell is going to schedule a vote this week. And we all spent much of last week talking about the president's, I think, unconscionable notion, whether you love him or hate him, that he's just going to let Obamacare fail. And we had people like Jonathan Gruber on last week, who are one of the architects of both Obamacare and Romneycare. How do you let it fail? And then there's a story in the last couple of days, is he's shutting down a lot of the phone exchanges, which allow people who are confused, which is all of us, to be able to get information about how to pick a health care plan. So and
you
cutting
can't sign
the period
up.
Essentially, right, you won't be able to sign up, at least sign up intelligently. It's going to be drip, drip, drip,
yeah,
right?
Well, I mean, this is not just letting it drown. This is pushing its head underwater and holding it down. And yeah, this is, you know, I don't know where, the mystery to me is where Trump stands on this policy-wise. I mean, there's this promise that we're going to repeal it, and then we're going to replace it with something that's so much better, but nobody knows what it is, and nobody's been able to come up with it. But where he stands, you know, where he actually stands on the policy of it has evolved and changed, because all of a sudden, as soon as he got into office, pre-existing conditions. Yeah, we ought to cover that. Oh, yeah, we should cover that, and we shouldn't let those people off the hook. So,
does he even want care about replacement at this point? Isn't it about the win? So, if he can get just repeal through without the replacement, wouldn't he take that?
He said something interesting in an interview with the New York Times last week with Maggie Haberman. She asked him whether he thinks generally that people ought to have health care, and he said yes. So I think when it goes to what he actually believes, she makes an interesting point that he's from New York City, where the government is pretty present and pretty active in supporting the least among the people who live in that grand metropolis.
Yeah, but wait a second. He comes from New York City, where there are tons of gays and lesbians. He's not good to them. He comes to New York City, where everybody smokes weed, and he has Jeff Sessions, who's going to crack down. And he used to support universal health care, quote, paid for by the government. I mean, it suggests there's no core. I mean, I know that's not an original thought,
right,
but that is
the point of my question.
Yeah. So let's assume that premise is correct, that there is no policy core. Yeah, I think he wants a win. That was a big part of the campaign. He promised it. It's on tape. It's clear. He has internalized that he promised that. There may be some things that he promised that he hasn't internalized that he promised. But he's internalized that a key part of his campaign and a key part of Republicans' campaign was to repeal and replace Obamacare. And if he comes away from this week – and this week is actually the end without something, it will be a loss.
Yeah, one last thing before we break. Since you mentioned pre-existing conditions, to me, it's hard to say what's the most hypocritical or at least unself-aware act. I would say this whole tweet he did on Charlie Gard, who's that 11-month-old kid in Great Britain who's got a fatal genetic disease. And by the way, I don't know if people read, but this morning his parents finally agreed we're going to stop they agreed with the courts we're going to stop care. Congress votes in a committee to grant permanent residency status to this family so that this 11-month-old kid can come to the United States with a pre-existing condition and get care when millions of people with pre-existing conditions aren't going to be able to afford care. And speaking about coming in from another country, and the Francisco Rodriguez's of the world, whose wife has a high-risk pregnancy coming due in August, could end up being deported today or tomorrow. I mean, it's just, it is staggering in its unself-awareness,
and,
I guess.
And staggering with how quickly we absorb the abomination and move on from it to the next abomination. It's like a tidal wave.
Because there's always a new tweet to
That's
talk
right.
about.
It's always a new tweet.
So basically what we're all saying is that we're all feeling very beleaguered. So we're going to take a break. we're going over the latest political news with Joshua Miller and Joanna Weiss. The conversation will continue with state and local politics on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Andrea Cabral, sitting in for Marjorie Egan for a couple of days, then Marjorie returns. If you're just tuning in, we're talking politics, now local and state, with Joanna Weiss and Boston Globe's Josh Miller.
So, I was going to ask you this.
But you're not anymore?
I'm not going to.
Oh, well, that.
We're moving on to state and local politics, but I really wanted to ask about the Simpson thing. So,
not OJ, by the way, but go ahead.
Guess where our governor ranks among the least and most popular governors as of the latest survey.
Well, I'm going to make a very educated guess and say he ranks number one in the country.
He does. He has a 71% approval rating, which is, nothing to sneeze at. This is according to a poll from Morning Consult. So, since he's got a 71% approval rating, let's talk about whether or not he's vulnerable and on what issues.
Short answer, probably not.
Not vulnerable at all?
I think overall not very vulnerable, because it's going to be really hard to get someone with a lot of gravitas and a real potential for a big base to run against him. I know there are people running, and no disrespect to them, but
disrespected them, no disrespect intended. Right? I just want to be clear.
You'll be hearing from them later.
There are definitely people who have complaints about him. They have complaints about the environment, and they have complaints about education, and there are complaints about how cagey he has been about his support or lack of support for Donald Trump. But he is also, following a long tradition of a Republican chief executive in a Democratic state that people in Massachusetts seem to really like. And he is, handling the operations in the way that he said he would when he ran.
And you mean the dynamic, in addition to apparently liking him personally, people like that dynamic of a Republican.
Yes, exactly. Okay. Exactly.
Speaking of Republicans, Democrats, weren't you as Secretary of Public Safety for a few months?
I was.
What
are you trying to say?
Nothing. I'm not trying to say. I just want to go in the spirit of full disclosure, which you obviously did not embrace. So you cover politics up there, Joshua Miller. Where are the vulnerabilities? I mean, I assume this is what Seti Warren, mayor of Newton, Gonzalez, who was the former head of ANF,
sure,
and Massey, who obviously we all know ran for lieutenant governor with Mark Roosevelt in 94, they're all looking for at least a thing to exploit. What are those things?
I think one of the reasons he has, again, 71% is job approval. It's not likability. It's not personal likability. It's job approval. Mm-hmm. 71% of people in Massachusetts, according to that new poll, think that he's, have a favorable view of how he's doing his job. And I think the reason for that, and based on my reporting with people across the Commonwealth and looking at internal and public polls, is that he's seen as trustworthy and he's seen as competent. And if Jay Gonzalez or Seti Warren or Bob Massey is able to chip away at the idea of him being a competent leader, of someone who can take the 40,000 plus employees in the executive branch and make them work well and make the things that most people interact with in terms of public transportation, paying their taxes, getting their license at the registry, if they can chip away at the idea that he's done those things well, that he's been a competent leader, I think that there is true vulnerability. I don't think we're going to see a Weldian, especially with Trump as president, I don't think we're going to see a Weldian kind of victory with, a gazillion point margin over whoever the Democratic
By the way, is. And when the Weldian victory over Mark Roosevelt in 94 was about by 40 points on that same ballot was the graduated income tax, which I was running the campaign of, which also lost by 40 points.
But he was running against John Silver.
No, not in 94. He's running against Mark Roosevelt.
Oh, that's right.
The silver election was a relatively close election in 1990.
I think we should watch for the Democratic contenders for the Democratic nomination for governor of Massachusetts to attempt to chip away at the idea that he's been a good steward of the Commonwealth's budget, of the $39 billion in taxpayer money. I think we should watch for them to chip away on the idea that he has been a good steward of healthcare in Massachusetts as a CEO, and whether or not they're successful on those fronts at chipping away the competence, I think will help determine how vulnerable or not he is.
I have to say, I you may be right, and you're much closer to them than I. I think they've already almost given up on that front. And I mean, this is all anecdotal, and seem to be attacking the vision thing. That even if it turns, and this is a year away, but there are three counts, that even if you are as competent, Charlie Baker, as your supporters say you are, what's the vision? What do you? And by the way, we've asked him this a million times. I mean, that's actually your boss, Brian McGorry, said to us last Wednesday. He thought that was a whole Brian McGorry out of the Globe, the vision thing. What would he say? What does he say? I mean, you know, I know what he says. His response is, and I'm paraphrasing, if you don't think getting the trains to run on time after they've been a mess and getting DCF, Department of Children and Families, in order isn't a vision thing, well, then whatever. But isn't that where they're probably going to go?
I mean, that was the big question about him when he ran in the first place, you know, or the second time when he won. Is he the guy with the big vision? And you know, one could argue that was his vulnerability against Deval Patrick, you know, I'm messing my years up. 2010. So in 2010, Deval Patrick's running again. Charlie Baker's trying to challenge him. And Deval Patrick really, you know, and he was an eloquent speaker for his vision and made that kind of passionate case. And Charlie Baker had that negative, it's not working and I'm going to fix it. It didn't work that time around. The next time around, he didn't run on a vision. People did not want a vision grander than excellent operations.
Right, but that was term one, I think, which is where you're going. And mm-hmm. So now that I'm, you know, I spent my $83 million or whatever it is, winterizing, whatever that means, you know, the tea. No, I mean, I didn't mean that disparagingly. The term doesn't, you know, just fixing the tea. But see, here's my thesis. The only reason I'm getting it, well, I love your reaction, both of you. I tried it out on Andrea this morning. I've only said it on the air about 100 times, so I'll say it in 101. On the same ballot as him is going to be the millionaire's tax to amend the Constitution. I think Charlie Baker is going to oppose it in a very modest, low-profile way, praying every night that it passes, so that for his hardcore anti-tax supporters, he was true to his pledge, and he gets to spend $2 billion a year that he opposed, and that funds his vision. Is that not a reasonable?
I totally agree, and I think he's very good at mildly opposing things.
Yes, yeah.
Well, most Republicans do that so that they get the benefit of the tax and don't have to worry about being on the record as actually supporting anything that would contribute to the Commonwealth.
Well, I want to hear what the State House guy says about that. Is that brilliant or is that brilliant? Tell the truth. Brilliant is the response.
I feel like there's only one right answer here, Jim.
My question, brilliant. Right? Okay.
But he hasn't said, I mean, we've asked him about 100 times when he's here once a month.
No, he's not taking a position.
And he's
on
really
it
not taking. I mean,
he always answers generally he opposes raising taxes.
Exactly,
that's what he ran on. But specifically, where he's going to wait. First, he wanted to wait for it to actually be on the ballot. And then once you asked him, once it was actually on the ballot, he said, well, there's going to be a lot of studies and information coming out. I want to be absorb all that information before I take a hard stance. And then there'll be another reason to kick it forward even further.
Are you done? Can I go now?
I'm done. Oh, yes. I want to get my idea on the table so I can claim credit for it when the time comes.
If I don't care if one or both of you answer this question, if either of you think that there is a Trump effect that will inure to his detriment, where do you think that shows up? I mean, the most criticism he's received is being too lukewarm on Trump in Massachusetts, because 80-something percent, you know, the state voted for Hillary Clinton. If that is going to work against him, where do you think that shows up? Not in job. It doesn't seem to be showing up in job approval because people, as you said, are looking at the mechanics of how he's doing his job. Where do you think it shows up, if at all?
Well, one thing, I think that the line he has to walk, people often forget that there were 1 million Trump voters in Massachusetts, 1 million. Those tend to be Republicans.
And the guy who was the head of Trump's campaign is running against Elizabeth Warren for Senate.
Well, he hasn't formally announced, but he is running.
Yeah.
State Rep. Jeff Deal.
So I think the governor, even as there is the potential for the Trump stuff in Washington to careen further and further away from the median point of where the median Massachusetts voter is, I think Baker's going to be careful not to go too far against Trump because, again, a base of support. He's got to get through a Republican primary. Presumably he'll have a not particularly effective opponent in the Republican primary, but presumably he'll have some hard right Republican running against him. So he's got to figure out a way to sort of get the middle ground. But yeah, I think if people – if the Republican brand gets so toxic in Massachusetts that it begins to sort of – hurt even Charlie Baker because of what Trump does, that could be a problem.
See, my strategy, last word from you, John, on this, is I don't know this at all. This is just my outside perspective, is I'll go as far as I can go, says Charlie Baker himself, on the actual policy that Josh mentioned. But the place where the contrast will be immense that I'm working really hard at is I'm going to work with, in the most respectful way possible, the Democratic legislature. Not only because I need them to get things done, but the contrast with the dysfunction in Washington and between the parties, not just – is immense. And that's how he counters the Trump crap in Washington.
So on any particular policy issue you're thinking about or just
no,
general
just,
function?
I work well with him. I have – even if I disagree, I have great respect for the Speaker, great respect for the Senate President. I think that's part of the strategy, as well as I think that's the kind of person he seems to be.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I think, again, he's just going to be as cagey as he can, you know, for all the reasons that Josh laid out. On every policy issue and contrast that comes up, from health care to immigration, he's going to play it as safe as he thinks he can play it.
Now, Josh, let me be clear here. When you refuse to answer my question, it's whether my strategy is brilliant. When you report on that, I expect credit for that analysis.
Yeah,
is that a given?
And I'll credit you as the brilliant Jim
exactly.
Rowdy
that's
WGBH.
What I'm looking for.
You should just trademark it.
Exactly.
It'd be so much easier.
I will. Thank you. Good to see you both.
Thanks, guys. Joanna Weiss is a journalist and reporter. Josh Miller covers politics for the Boston Globe. He also writes for the Political Happy Hour. Joanna Weiss and Joshua Miller, thank you so much for joining us. Up next, we're opening the lines, asking you, is the departure of Sean Spicer the end of an era? Keep your dial on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Are you Marjorie Egan?
Sometimes I'm Marjorie Egan in my dreams.
Let's start this all over again. So am I, actually, in my dreams. Welcome back to Boston Public Radio, as I tried to say a minute ago. I'm Jim Browdy. She is not Marjorie Egan. She is Andrea Cabral, kind enough to sit in for Marjorie Egan for a couple of days. Marjorie will be back later this week. In the era of Trump, the Washington Post, you know this, has adopted the tagline, democracy dies in darkness. I have to say, well, I love the Washington Post. That, to me, is a bit, gives me heebie-jeebies. In any case, it's something that Sean Spicer acted out literally a couple of months ago when he hid from the press in the bushes. Remember this?
Yeah.
Only to emerge after journalists agreed to talk to him in, quote, near darkness. That was just one of many highlights or lowlights of his tenure, depending on how you viewed Spicer. Was he comic relief or a symptom of an unstable and inept White House? We're opening the lines asking if you're going to miss Spicer. 877-301-8970. Did the gaffes, his constant state of exasperation, his rookie moves give us a glimpse into what was going on in the White House? Or is it a disservice to the U.S. to have a spokesperson who was the human embodiment of chaos? 877-301-8970. In addition to people commenting on the Spicer departure, the point I made to you and Josh Miller and Joanna Weiss, I think, is the most significant one. Two of his key advisors are Reince Priebus, his chief of staff,
yes,
and Steve Bannon, his key policy guy. And the fact that they didn't know that Scaramucci was coming in to get a job and that they then said, we oppose it, as did Spicer, and they were ignored. And Scaramucci reports directly to the president, which a director of communications never does, leads me to conclude, which may matter to people, may not, that he listens to absolutely nobody except himself.
And I think you're absolutely right about that. And even though I push back on this notion that, you know, it's overwhelming to, you know, have this goal of working at the White House and then suddenly find yourself there and that it blinds you to a lot of realities, I think you're probably right about it, because Bannon hasn't resigned. Priebus has been actively pushing back, you know, on reporters about whether or not his job is in jeopardy. And Sean Spicer took to the podium the very first thing Trump had him do, and everyone agrees that this had to be at Trump's insistence, was to lie about the size of his inauguration crowds. And he did it, and he did it with such stridence that it became an immediate meme. It became there were GIFs everywhere.
That was laughable.
And it was just Melissa McCarthy was in almost instantly as to parody him on SNL, which he then was humiliated for because it embarrassed Trump. And he did what Trump asked him to do, and he suffered mightily for it. And also suffered at the hands of the guy who made him do it.
Do you remember Trump told him to get a new suit after the first that first day?
Because it was ill-fitting around
exactly.
the neck.
877-301-8970. So what's your reaction to the Spicer thing? If you want to respond narrowly, because he was one of a kind, let's face it, that's fine. But if you want to speak to the issue about what it says, the bringing on of Scaramucci and the disappearance of Spicer. Speaking of Scaramucci, can you guys get the sound of Scaramucci, his comment, oh, I think it was on Jake Tapper over the weekend, about Spicer's replacement, about how she should use the same hair and makeup person who she used on Friday, which was rather amazing. 877-301-8970. The most uninformed, and it's pretty hard to rank them, I would argue, the most uninformed moment for Sean Spicer, and since it's about the most serious of subjects, I would say the most egregious, is you'll remember when he was describing the difference between Hitler and Assad in Syria. This is a press briefing back, I think it was in April. Here's Spicer.
You had someone as despicable as Hitler who didn't even sink to using chemical weapons. So you have to, if you're Russia, ask yourself, is this a country that you and a regime that you want to align yourself with? He was not using the gas on his own people the same way that Assad is doing. I mean, there was clearly – I understand your point. Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate that. There was not in the – he brought him into the to the Holocaust Center. I understand that.
Into the Holocaust
Center.
Like
it's a place you go to sign up for for day camp. I mean, that one really was, that was painful to listen to because he just kept making it worse. But again, he was pushing an idea forward, probably at the request of his boss, that was tenuous at best in terms of how much water it held, and he ended up stumbling over himself trying to make an inept comparison.
He did. And by the way, when he said Al-Assad or whatever he said at the end there, remember the moment, which we'll play for you in a couple of seconds, where Wolf Blitzer said something like, I know you're having a hard time pronouncing that. I mean, talk about humiliation.
But
was just
stayed.
Epic.
He stayed.
But see, this is where you and I have a difference of opinion. Yeah. By the way, you like to think, and I like to think, that if you're embarrassed or undercut, no job is important enough to have your credibility and your honor, you know, attacked. But I really think, I've never been in a position like that, but I think it's a different, if you're a spokesperson in politics, what's the one job that everybody wants? It's great. You have Chuck Schumer, you have Mitch McConnell, you have the governor of Massachusetts, whatever it is. The president of the United States. You continue to delude yourself every day into saying, well, tomorrow will be better. And I really can convince him. I think, but there is a point, you're right, when it runs dry. And by the way, the other day, to his credit, even though you say he didn't resign, he resigned when he could have stayed there with Scaramucci as the director of communications. We decided it was too much.
But that was the straw that broke the camel's back, not standing in front of a press with incredulous looks on their faces because you're lying again today about a particular thing. But here's my other thing. I mean, I don't know this for sure, but I don't think that Sean Spicer goes home and lives alone and sleeps in a pod and doesn't have interaction with anybody else. He has a family and friends. Wouldn't you think that those people would be saying to you, I just want to let you know, we've been watching you on TV and no job is worth this.
Well, Donald Trump has a family and friends too. And do you think any of them are telling him similar things about some of the things that he's doing?
No, because they're connected by money and power, I think, and a sense of greed. This was a $179,000 a year job. In fact, he wasn't making enough that he could apparently afford to buy his own mini fridge, according to
tell
the story.
I didn't know that story all day. Can you please tell that story?
Apparently, once he was ensconced in his office near the press briefing room, he mentioned to a staffer, I forget exactly who, that he really wanted a mini fridge so that he could keep his drinks cold and so forth. And I think he was told that they would not buy a mini fridge for him, that the White House wouldn't foot that bill, but he found out that there were some junior staffers in a different
office.
This
is the most pathetic.
And
yet.
They had a mini fridge in their different office, in their office. And so he called them because he's thinking, I'm the press secretary, so, you know, tell them I want their mini fridge. If you're not going to buy me one, tell them I want theirs. And the staffer said, no, you can't have our mini fridge. I don't blame them at all. So after the staffers, this is according to the report in the Business Insider. So I'll just read from the report. The staffers reportedly refused to give him the mini fridge. As a result, Spicer was forced to wait until the evening when the staffers had all left and was, quote, spotted by a fellow White House official lugging the icebox down the White House driveway after 8 p.m. So...
what does that say to you? By the way, we're having technical difficulties, which is why we're not getting your calls. It'll be fixed in about 60 seconds. So stay the course, and we will get to you all, we promise, at 877-301-8970. So what's your takeaway from the mini fridge gate?
Well, it makes him even more pathetic, in my view, because it was sort of a power play. We used to do this, and it's not unusual in government. We used to do these things called midnight runs. So if someone left the office, government, as you know, has furniture that sort of dates back to colonial times. Mm-hmm. And, you know, things are at a premium.
Did you steal a mini fridge?
No, I've never stolen. I actually brought in a mini fridge for my office.
Your own?
And let other people. Oh, yes. Oh, absolutely.
So nice.
You'd be surprised how many people in government buy their own stuff. But whenever someone would vacate an office, if they had anything remotely desirable, and this could be pens, right, and paper, right? We're not talking about frills. This is like basic stuff. You would do a midnight run, and you would take whatever you could, and the person who would come in to replace that person would literally come in. There would be maybe a desk and a chair in the office. They would get none of...
That's like me in a hotel room. Same sort of experience.
It's, right. It's the free shampoo and conditioner thing.
Let's go to... and the robes and the...
Actually take the robes.
Go for the gold.
You're the reason TVs are bolted to the floor?
We've had these discussions. Yes, that may be true. Bob in Pembroke. Sorry it took so long. Welcome to Boston Public Radio with Andrew Cabral and me, Jim Browdy. Welcome.
That's okay. Hey, good morning. I'm actually not a supporter of Trump or Spicer, but I must say that... in some respects, I'm happy that he resigned. I think it's always a good thing when we get a chance to see someone demonstrate self-respect.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm happy to see that he finally did that. I was amazed that he hung on as long as he did.
Well, you know, the ultimate insult, I tend to agree with you. I'm a big fan of self-respect, too. They say the biggest insult, you know, he's a big-time Catholic and really cares about his religion. Do you remember when Donald Trump went to see the Pope and Spicer was with them and he was not invited into the meeting with the Pope, which
terrible.
Most people who know Spicer personally say might have been the most important experience of his whole life.
Sure?
And that was purely to humiliate him. So I'm not a big Spicer fan either, but I tend to agree
with
you.
That was terrifically
Thank you, Bob.
Mean. I mean, what would it have taken to allow a man who that's the one thing he wants to do, whether you like him or not? I mean, you know.
In any case, let's go to Beth in Newport, Rhode Island. You're on Boston Public Radio. We're talking about Sean Spicer and what it means that Sean Spicer is gone. Hi there, Beth.
Hi, Jim. Hi. I just wanted to say that Rhode Island is the proud owner of Sean Spicer.
Oh, that's right. I forgot about that.
I'm from Rhode Island, and I forgot about that.
Yeah.
He grew up in Barrington. He was educated at Portsmouth Abbey, the elite prep school.
Ooh. But you're not doing the whole thing. In addition to the home of Sean Spicer, do you know who has been, I'm told, either windsurfing or really surfing or something in Rhode Island?
Yeah, Mike Flynn.
Mike Flynn, General Mike Flynn. That's right.
The Breakers are a great place to go.
So go ahead.
Benedict Flynn.
So what do you make of this?
I went to high school with him.
What? Who did? Who did?
I did.
You went to high school with Flynn?
Yes.
And what are you going to tell us about him?
Well, let me finish. You keep interrupting, Jim.
Oh, that's right. Okay, go ahead.
Okay. Mike Flynn ended up doing some time in juvenile detention.
Oh, wait a second.
Because he stole...
We can't do that. I trust you. We can't. Well, it's fine, but I don't know it. And do you know about it, Andrea?
No.
I don't think we can really get into that because since we don't, if it's not true, it's whatever. So, Beth, thanks for the Rhode Island history, but we're going to have to move on. 877-301-8970. Steve, you're in Burlington. You're on Boston Public Radio. Hi, Steve.
Hey, Hey, Jim. Good afternoon. Hey, after I give you my Sean Spicer thing, I was wondering if you'd allow me to ask you one question on the Russian probe.
Maybe. We'll see. I'm kidding.
Sean Spicer had to go. He had the wrong temperament for the job. He was too argumentative. He didn't have the right demeanor, in my opinion. Now, in the Russia thing, I want to ask you your opinion. What is the difference? Let's just say Russia did do what they did. Right. What is the difference between Russia releasing all that information or when the New York Times or the Washington Post releases an article about someone having an affair or someone doing this? Or what's the difference? Just because Russia is a different country?
No, just because Russia is a foreign adversary and the New York Times is one of the great newspapers in the world, which occasionally makes a mistake. Other than the fact
that important to have the information no matter where it came from, as long as it's accurate and it's not a lie. I'm more upset at what Hillary did as opposed to the information. It seems people are more mad at the information as opposed to what Hillary did.
Well, first of all, there allegedly was no information according to Donald Trump Jr. and the others. The fact that Donald Trump Jr. believed that he was about to go meet with a representative of a foreign adversary and get, quote, incriminating evidence on his father's opponent. To me, I'm no constitutional expert, but that's pretty close to conspiracy, or at least desire to conspire with an adversary. So the answer is to compare it to the New York Times, with all due respect, is almost embarrassing. I mean, but Andrea, go ahead.
It's not, because if it's right, if the information is correct, they woke up the American people saying, hey,
oh, wait a second. Kim Jong-un just called. He's got some information, too. Let's send Tillerson.
Now you're making a joke.
No, I'm not at all.
But what makes you let me just move back here for a second. What makes you think that that the information would be accurate? And more importantly, what makes you think that the Trump campaign would have cared whether or not it was accurate? Okay. I'm just putting aside for a second the fact that you don't seem to be bothered by a foreign adversary trying to rig an election.
Go ahead.
I'm going straight to... Finish.
If the information was inaccurate, they would have said so, and they would have
said it a thousand times
it was wrong.
Who would have said so?
Hillary Clinton.
No.
That's wrong. It's a lie. No one ever said it.
Because and you're saying that because any time something was said about Hillary Clinton that was a lie, if she were to tell you that it was a lie, that would be good enough for you, right?
But it's totally irrelevant. Steve, excuse me. Getting information from a credible newspaper as opposed to a foreign adversary which is trying to undermine democracy, the fact that you're equating them in the same sentence is insane. But having said that, thank you.
You're saying that the newspaper is credible. They can put a story out, right, and it's in page one, and then 2 days later, oh, I'm sorry, it's a mistake.
Exactly.
And it's page 80.
They can do that.
They correct themselves, but it also doesn't happen very much that they're that inaccurate that it requires a correction.
Steve, thanks for the call. And by the way, Scaramucci, I would argue, is on the path to fill the shoes of Sean Spicer quite well. Here he is on Jake Tapper yesterday, State of the Union, speaking about Jake Tapper's successor, Sarah Huckabee Sanders. Is that the last name? Here is Scaramucci.
The only thing I asked Sarah, if you're watching, I love the hair and makeup person that we had on Friday, so I'd like to continue to use the hair and makeup person.
Now, I assume you have no problem with that, because obviously he couldn't reach her on the phone.
I didn't think he was talking about her.
Are you kidding? He subsequently said, I'm speaking about myself. So he's using Jake Tapper's audience to remind Sarah, to remind him that he should use the same makeup and hair person?
You know what? I have to say, it's not like I like this guy. But when I heard him say it, I didn't have that reaction to it.
I had exactly that reaction. And then he did one of those walkbacks, one of my most favorite expressions from the last couple of years, walking something back. I thought it was... He's also the most perfectly coiffed, most perfectly dressed,
right,
most perfectly whatever.
Which is why I thought it was entirely conceivable that he thought, with his sort of Carnival Barker attitude, let me give a shout out to the hair and makeup person so they keep taking care of me, because he really does seem to care about his appearance quite a little bit.
Well, maybe you're much more kind soul than I. John and Gardner, you're next on Boston Public Radio. We just have a minute or so, John. Shoot.
Morning, kids.
Hey.
Andrew, normally I'd assure a guest hostess that I could come in and slap Jim around if he got out of line, but I know you can handle that.
Unfortunately, she can, yes.
Hey, listen, Sean was somewhat flawed. I'll agree to that. But I think he was representative of what a mess this administration is in cross purposes, cross communications, and just a cross mess. And you sort of stole a little bit of my thunder, Jim, but I think Mr. Scaramucci might be quite entertaining in his own right.
Do you know who he went to law school with and played basketball with while they were in law school? I didn't know this till this weekend. Barack Obama. They went to Harvard Law School.
He actually said it.
Yeah.
In a forum.
Pugnacious, the adjective that comes to mind with Mr. Scaramucci?
What's that?
Pugnacious?
Oh, I think so. Yeah, I think so. But but don't you think that's what Trump is looking
exactly.
for?
Exactly.
John,
exactly.
Thanks as always.
I agree with him.
Oops.
I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
I don't think he has the best poker face in the world. I saw him on a couple of the different shows, and you could sort of see when he thought that the interviewer was getting to him a little bit as opposed to him being in control. Maybe that's just me, but I would say look for that going forward.
John, thanks. And by the way, since we're ending our conversation about Sean Spicer, here's The Daily Show, Trevor Noah's tearful farewell to Spicer with a little accompanying music. Here it is.
Guys, good morning, good afternoon.
Good evening, good afternoon.
You're shaking your head. I appreciate it, but with respect to... hold on 1 second. You don't get to just yell out questions. We're going to raise our hand like big boys and girls. Denmark as a education point. Points.
Bashar al-Assad. I know you've mispronounced his name a few times.
That's a beautiful tribute, I think, on your way.
That was so bad.
Yeah. See, you know what my final analysis is of this? Is that Donald Trump decided to pick people who are not, I want to be as kind as I can be to a guy who lost his job, not really up to the job, because he believed they are more likely to be willing to say and do things that smarter people might not be.
And make him look better.
Maybe so.
All right. So two of President Trump's closest advisors, one of them his own son-in-law, are testifying before Congress or meeting with Congress in a closed-door affair. Juliette Kayyem joins us for that and more. She is next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Noon on today's Boston Public Radio, it's Homeland Security expert Juliette Kayyem. We'll talk Washington and San Antonio, where 9 undocumented immigrants are dead in the back of a tractor trailer.
I'm Andrea Cabral, in for Marjorie Egan. Neuroscientist Frances Jensen looks at teenage behavior by way of brain development. She explains why they are bad at making decisions, prone to impulses, and susceptible to drugs and alcohol. From there, we get TV authority Bob Thompson's take on the best and worst TV moments of the week. Reverends Irene Monroe and Emmett Price join us for All Revved Up and their take on some of the moral dilemmas of the day. Then we ask you about one of those dilemmas, the practice of the Dunkin' Double Cup. Why do people need a styrofoam cup to go with their iced coffee? That's next on Boston Public Radio.
From a transmitter atop Great Blue Hill, this is WGBH, live, local talk, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Browdy, and she is Andrea Cabral, sitting in for the next couple of days for Marjorie Egan. How's it going so far?
Actually, it's going quite well. I'm having quite a good time.
And even when we're in between, we're getting along relatively well.
You're a lovely host.
A couple of months ago, when the latest season of House of Cards premiered, actress Robin Wright said, "Trump has stolen all of our ideas." Maybe he's also stealing ideas from Juliette Kayyem, who 2 weeks ago said that Donald Trump would pardon Donald Trump Jr. Of course, Trump is also looking, maybe, into pardoning Donald Trump the original. Speaking of pardons, by the way, Jared Kushner, who, as you know, spoke before the Senate Intelligence Committee this morning, will be making a statement, we believe, in the next few minutes. If he does, we'll bring part of it to you live. But in the interim, here here with us in Studio 3 for a take on this and other national security headlines is Juliette Kayyem. Juliette is host of the SCIF podcast, founder of Kayyem Solutions, and an analyst for CNN and WGBH. And she is now the proud recipient of a mug, and I feel horrible, that one of our listeners at the library gave us, with a beautiful picture of Juliette on it. I mentioned this on the air to you. And on the side it says, Kayyem Egan in 2020.
Oh, is that the
congratulations.
Awesome. I've heard about the legendary mug.
What, you want to make a comment?
Is this what it, what? Wait, it's, where's Marjorie's
it's actually,
picture?
It's a really lovely mug.
It in.
It's a fabulous.
Well, you're at the top of the ticket.
I'm so oh, that's
honored.
Right.
You're
of
so
course.
Honored.
Whoever did this, I may be in love with you. I am
beautiful.
In love with you. Thank you so much. I'm going to drink this every morning. And guess what our motto is?
What is it?
Pace the rage.
Oh, is that on there too?
That's my 2020 motto.
I didn't even...
Pace the rage.
Those are wise words. I can't abide by them in any way.
I know. I've been
form,
listening. I know. We words. Need to talk. We yeah. need to talk.
In any case, good to see
this
you, Julia.
This is all good. Everything is good. And, you know, if all else fails, it is Shark Week. So that's all that matters.
Yeah, but Michael Phelps lost to the shark. So.
Well, and it was, I mean, I am one of those people who actually believed he
so
was going to be racing
so
a shark.
I. Because they even though they did kind of have the disclaimer, they promoted it in a
I
way that was designed
you.
To
wait a
make
second.
It
so you thought great. The shark was going to stay in its lane
yes.
as it was competing?
Yeah. In fact, I had a conversation
oh,
with
God.
How do they get the shark to stay
it's
in
really
the lane?
Disturbing.
No, I thought
you
there might
what?
Be like a divider, but yeah. you'd be able to see both of them swimming
you give
forward.
Me Homeland and National Security, and I am sophisticated, but when it comes
apparently
to shark
not.
Week, I rely on anything.
In any case, we're glad to have you here.
Okay, thank you for having me here, although... there are worse things or probably better things than to be potentially bumped by Jared Kushner.
Is Juliette's mic working, by the way? I don't think so. Do you want her to switch mics or should she switch to the other mic there? Can you do you mind yeah, moving yeah, to the other mic? This is Juliette Kayyem, and she's moving to the other mic. This is radio behind the scenes.
That one's probably working.
And now say something.
That we'll is working.
It is working.
Is this
okay.
the one Joanna Weiss was at?
Yeah.
I'm going to blame her. Oh, totally.
Yes.
She
so
does
good.
That
Joanna
all
Weiss
the
dust,
time. She turns
it
off. It's a big joke for her.
Okay, here we are.
Hi,
so,
everyone.
I want to ask you about this and get your take on this closed-door session with Kushner and Manafort. Now, a scant week ago, it was about them coming in and testifying under oath and testifying in public. And in fact, if memory serves, Grassley and Feinstein were sort of chest thumping a little bit about if, you know, they were asked, well, what if they don't show up? Well, we have the ability to subpoena them. That has all sort of just slowly circled the drain to a, we'll give you some of our paperwork. We'll show up and answer some of your questions. And they're not, it's just not happening.
Right.
What's your take on it?
So I never thought it would happen. So there is no way that that hearing was going to happen. And, you know, the more, I would say, the more animated someone is to testify in an open congressional hearing, I would say the less likely it is to happen, being someone who's had to testify about actually bad things, too. So so I sort of knew it was never going to happen. So here's my understanding of what happened. There's a which is essentially there's still a law that you can't lie to Congress. So we can't walk in there and say
still
I have never worked.
Right.
There is a law.
That you can't lie to Congress.
That's
there's
today.
Law, so,
okay,
right. Note the date and time.
Right,
that
exactly.
could change.
But so and that Grassley and Feinstein used the threat of the subpoena to ensure that he would come to at least some discussion and would not take the Fifth.
And provide documents
and
that sort of thing.
And stuff like that. So in some ways, they ratcheted up to give him a space to ratchet it down. I don't know if it's going to work. I know a lot of people wanted that hearing. Certainly CNN did. You know, they had us all like, you know, what do you clear out the day? You know, everyone was waiting for it. I've been reading a lot from people who are congressional staff. They say this forum is actually better for getting information. Because let's just, you know what's going to happen next. It's going to be all put in a folder and delivered to Mr. Robert Mueller.
Right. I mean,
so
it's a perjury.
And that's,
So it's a
so
perjury
they're setting
trap.
Up the, it's a perjury trap. And it's also a, well, we have Jared Kushner. And this is what I was talking about last week or last Wednesday. You know, what you're seeing is the conspiracy unwind. No one knows. You have got a collective action problem. No one knows
what the other did and what the other is saying. So there's a story over the weekend, not confirmed by anyone else, but I'm now forgetting who wrote it, but a legitimate newspaper saying that that Mueller is trying to turn Manafort.
That's what we were talking about.
Oh, yeah.
So, no, before we went on the air, I was going to ask you about that. So tell us what you know.
So that's interesting. I don't know if it's true or not. Even if it's not true, that's a lot of times what prosecutors do is that they'll leak to a reporter saying we're trying to turn him. And Jared and Don Jr. Right. And Sessions and everyone get worried. Oh, my God, Manafort. I had a conversation with him about colluding with the Russians. There's also a series of characters that we don't talk about who, to me, as someone who now believes that there was collusion and I'm just waiting for it to be proved. I mean, I think for me, the aha moment was, of course, that meeting with the about adoptions, allegedly. There are people that we're not hearing from, which is always interesting, who are the people that have not gone public. And one of them is the data guy at the campaign.
Right.
Who's been in
Parscale.
And out. Yeah. What's his name again?
His last name is Parscale. I think Parscale. His first name is.
Yeah, I don't remember.
It's either Brad or Giles.
Yeah, so
I don't know why I can't.
He's the guy who basically would have been involved with micro-targeting in terms of helping the right. Russians figure out
and
where they wanted
to. And was paid $72 million.
Yeah.
By the Trump campaign,
really?
That's the FEC report that I saw over, and not like necessarily over a period of time.
But
so
that was,
he was just listed as the digital guy.
Yeah, the data guy. Yeah,
that's
right,
a
exactly.
lot
that's
to
a
get.
Lot
that's
for
a lot of money for.
By the way, Reuters
like
is the organ news
yeah,
organization that reported the Manafort potentially being turned. The thing I don't understand is when you were talking a couple of minutes ago, and obviously Andrew, you're a former prosecutor, so you understand what Juliet's talking about better than I. Is this whole behind the scenes? They'll get better information. That I understand because people aren't playing to the camera. Then they hand it to Mueller. But it seems to me that Congress is also intent. Much of Congress, yeah. Maybe not so much the Burr-Warner axis because they've been acting like grown-ups in the Senate Intelligence Committee. They're also egomaniacs. Yeah. And the notion that they're content with having an off-the-record, not off-the-record, I'm sorry, a non-public hearing and we'll just turn the information over to Mueller so we will have done our duty, to me... Doesn't
See,
fit the MO of most of these
yes,
men and women.
Yes, that's what has got to be terrifying Trump. I mean, in other words, look, I know there's a group of people who, you know, feel like, you know, the world is crumbling, everything. If you look hard enough, not if you look hard enough, if you look in the right places, and you're Donald Trump, you would be very nervous. One is the number of hearings that are going on, the number of calls for witnesses that are occurring under threat or penalty by a Republican Senate is shocking. I mean, in other words, if you really thought that the Republicans weren't doing anything, why are we having these hearings? What's going on here? And so I think you're seeing a little bit. I'm not going to say they're heroes in the making yet, but with Burr and Grassley, a couple others, Paul Ryan this morning on a radio show, I just read to you what he said. He's on a radio show. He defends Robert Mueller. If you're the White House, you don't have your Speaker of the House ready to throw Robert Mueller under the bus. You now have a strategy. What's your strategy? What is your strategy? And there's other things going on. I wrote about this weekend, just for your listeners to know. There's something else. The Aspen is this big security conference. It's got a lot of media attention because the former CIA director and the former head of
Brennan and Clapper
essentially did something I've never thought that the two men would ever do, which was, you know, publicly throw the president under the bus. I mean, at one stage, Clapper says, I think his only goal is to make Russia great again. But what was lost in some of issues surrounding them is that every cabinet or senior staff member from the Trump administration who spoke at Aspen, because they bring in all the cabinet secretaries, validated the intelligence community publicly. And that includes Pompeo. That includes the Homeland Security Advisor. That includes who else was on that list? The Rogers, the head of the NSA. There's just a long list of people. And if you're Trump, once again, your cabinet is now going publicly against you on the issue that could bring you down. I'm just saying, you're looking at all this stuff. I know why he wakes up in the morning pissed off.
Well, you know, and apparently trusting nobody. One of the things we discussed with listeners and with Josh Miller and John Weiss before you got here was the whole Spicer, not dismissal, but de facto dismissal. And the thing that stuck with me, I hate to say this for the third time in the first hour and a half on the show, is not so much even the Spicer thing, because he's a bit player in the grand scheme of things. When I read all these reports about how not only did Steve Bannon and Reince Priebus, the chief policy person, one of the chief policy people and the chief of staff to the president, not know that Scaramucci was coming into the White House to be interviewed for director of communications or to be given the job, but they then opposed it, and the president did it anyway. It's one thing to do it to a bit player like Spicer, who you don't really have much respect for if you're the president. To do it to your two key advisors, there's some message in that.
What is the message in it? Well, I think Trump is sort of cowardly. I think that's how he has yet to fire anyone. He throws these salvos out. He wants Sessions to quit. Well, if you want your AG out, you know.
Well, he fired Comey, though. But I mean, that got him in.
Well, he didn't even call Comey. He sent someone else to send a letter. In other words, where is the mojo here? You know, I mean, for a guy who talks enough, the Sessions thing is absolutely crazy. If you want Sessions out, fire him. He doesn't, you know, he wants Sessions to resign, which as a strategy, I don't get. At this stage, keep Sessions close. What the heck are you thinking at this stage?
Because you're worried he'll turn too.
Oh my
he never
God,
seems
yes.
to think about that. He didn't think about that with Comey.
Keep him close.
Yes. Even the only person he seemed to care a little bit about was Flynn. But that seemed to me to be born out of his desire to really keep Flynn there as his national security advisor, not so much a worry about if I fire him, you know, is he going to go out and say bad things about me? But here's the part that I don't get. Why people are always so surprised about this. You remember the stories about The Apprentice, right? So in The Apprentice, the producers ended up actually saying he would decide at the beginning of the show who was going to win, and we would have to build the show around that conclusion. That's someone who makes his decisions, decides what it is that he wants to do, and he really doesn't care whether it's staff on a show or staff in the White House actually say.
And I think, you know, the Spicer thing, no sympathy from this, from me. I don't even, you know, these stories that you're hearing about how mean Trump is, that he didn't let him meet the Pope. I mean, Sean Spicer has to live with his legacy, and that's a legacy of using the podium that is the place where the United States government is supposed to speak to the American people through the media. The media isn't the audience. The American people are, and used it to
tell
lie
the target.
After lie after lie.
Right.
So good riddance. And then I say to the new guy, did you know he went to Harvard Law School, by the way?
With
did you
Barack
hear that?
Obama.
Yeah, did you hear that?
He says that.
Yeah, he does say that.
Oh, you're joking.
Yeah.
I see.
Yeah.
Okay,
so, Julia, good luck to him.
Now, Julia Kayyem, 2 weeks ago when you were here, when you mentioned the pardons were coming, Marjorie was so freaked out she had to go on vacation for a week.
Yeah.
She still hasn't come back.
She hasn't even texted me.
You know, I still can't get my arms around this whole notion. Forget the whole debate about whether he can pardon himself. You know, the Larry Tribes of the world say no. The Jonathan Turleys of the world from GWS, one of your colleagues at CNN, says yes. But leave that for the moment. It would seem to me if anything would cause Republicans who are sitting on the fence to turn on the president and say, this is it. I just can't defend this anymore. It would be pardons of family members, of Kushner, of the son, of Manafort.
Yeah.
Possible?
When I say this, when I say things like on the show 2 weeks ago, look, we have to seriously start thinking that he is going to use the pardon power. It's not like I want it to happen. If you come from the belief that Trump is trying to keep illegal behavior quiet, and as I've been honest with you, I don't know what that illegal behavior is. Is it the collusion? Possible. Very, very possible.
You've been saying it's the
financial,
finances. Yeah.
It's the finances. That's where, I think it's clear, and that they're cash poor, and that's why he needs all this money. Is it the dossier and some of the allegations in the dossier? Who knows?
And the Russian, the dossier collected by the British guy.
Yeah,
the Steele dossier.
So, you know, and then you just have to think, what would you do if you were him? And as a legal matter, the pardons don't save him because they can't assert, once they're pardoned, they can't assert the Fifth. And it doesn't pardon them from state crime. So whatever's going on in the state AG's office in New York would still harm
around
Jared.
People like Manafort, for example.
Yeah. By Schneiderman, the AG there. Nonetheless, it's a move that Trump would make because as much chaos as he can generate makes it harder to find the truth. Do I think that will be a moment in which his 30% turn against him? No. Do I think, though, that the fact that there's not a lot of defenders that you're hearing, in particular in the Senate anymore, of his behavior means that they might start to be more public? Absolutely. And I think it's easier for him to pardon than to fire Mueller. I think Mueller is actually the scarier one.
You know, speaking of the Senate, this has nothing to do with what we're talking about, but it just you reminded me of something that deserves 45 seconds of mention, is the fact that this woman, Kelly Ward, who ran against John McCain in a primary last time and is now running in a primary against Senator Flake, another Republican, said the day after John McCain, it was disclosed that he had the condition he had, that he should resign immediately. To me, is as callous and low whether you're a McCain.
I think she's a doctor.
Oh my God. It is just as foul as it comes. I'm sorry, Andrea. I just had to get that out of my system.
And, you know, to the extent I should say something about McCain, and I know, you know, people wish that he's like this or like that, and his maverickness and Sarah Palin, all that stuff. There are criticisms of him, but I want to say one thing from the National Security and Foreign Policy Circle. To the extent that other nations view John McCain as someone that they can still go to, is really has very much animated this presidency. In other words, while the White House is dysfunctional, it looks like McMaster may already be on his way out. We're going to talk about
Tillerson. Is that true?
Yeah, McMaster's on the out, and Tillerson, there's lots of rumors that he is already speaking about leaving before year's end, which I think John King, our friend, called, which is brilliant. I don't know if he made it up, but called a Rexit, which I love.
That is good.
Yeah.
That is
good.
Really
so
soft.
I mean, to the extent that that it is good, all of us as a nation were very dependent on McCain, whether we knew it or not, is also another loss right now as he figures out what his future plans are. I mean, obviously, he would be a great voice to still have. But, you know, as all of us have encountered loss, you also want someone to be stress free in what may be the last years of their life.
We're talking to Juliet Kayyem, the host of the Skiff podcast. My small question on the pardons is, what makes you think that there's any sort of critical analysis by Trump about the consequences of the pardon? Like, we've been talking about the fact that he doesn't listen to anybody. So what makes you think that the Office of Legal Counsel or anybody else telling him that he couldn't do something would result in him not doing it?
Well, I am reading stories at least about that his new counsel has told him about the Fifth Amendment problem and the state problem, that it doesn't solve everything. But, you know, that's like assuming that Trump, it's just what you said earlier, is, you know, it takes the long view, right? He's, you know, I used to say about President Obama, like, whatever your criticisms were of him on that day, he really did take the long view, right? In terms of, you know, and so Trump's the exact opposite. So what moves him that day? And, you know, some legal theory that, you know, yes, you could pardon them today. Maybe you could survive the political unrest related to that. But 2 months from now, Jared's still going to get a subpoena to go have to testify.
And if he refused to, he'd be held in contempt.
Yeah.
Like,
right.
I'm sorry.
Yeah. So that's right. Where we are. But it's, you know, this is, you know, I feel honestly that the next 3 weeks are like nothing this nation would have encountered.
I couldn't agree with you more.
And it began, and, you know, and this morning his tweet storm of anger and craziness was, I think, a sign that he sees that too. His options are, is he going to fire Mueller? Is he going to grant the pardons? Is he going to veto or not veto the Russia sanctions bill? And let me say, if he does not veto it, because it is veto proof, so he might as well not veto it, what will Putin do in response?
And that creates the kind of panic that makes people worry about the size of the distraction that he may deem necessary to get this off the front page.
By the way, Jared Kushner, just as we were speaking, left the committee. While he was smiling broadly and yelled a few words out at many, many reporters, he did not stop to make a statement. He got into the van or car or whatever it is and is on his way. He may speak later. If he does, we'll bring it to you. And if he doesn't, we won't.
Well, given the statement he made before he went in, which is everything's fine, nothing to see here. I didn't collude. I couldn't even remember the guy's name. I had to email for Kislyak's name because I couldn't remember it. I'm no matter what happened inside, he would have probably come out waving, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's right.
Yeah.
We're all good here. Everything is good.
And by the way, it's a pretty I hope someone asks him if he does do a little press availability. If Rex Tillerson does resign, will he also be Secretary of State? Why not?
I think that would be fantastic. I think Jared is well qualified. I mean, his letter today, literally, not only did it throw Don Jr. under the bus, but, you know, this the male privilege reeking through that. I was so busy. I had so much stress and, you know, we were moving the kids. I mean, he literally says that in the letter. I'm like, if a woman did that,
right.
I mean, they would be like...
She'd be low stamina.
Yeah. Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
We only have a couple of minutes
left. Can you get your...
I do want to get your take on this truck that was left in the San Antonio Walmart parking lot. And apparently, I don't know if we have the name of the individual yet. I think his last name is it Baker?
What's the name of the we're asking people in the control room. What's the
Florida.
Name of the driver of the car from Clearwater, Florida, please? Could someone put it in the...
And so, what is it, 100 people left in this... and just left there literally
dead,
to die.
Right?
Yeah.
And there aren't words for the level of tragedy that this represents. But my question to you is more about ICE's efforts of being focused on removing people who've committed no crimes from this country. And this end that results in death for people who are just struggling to get here and also has the component of American conspirators or compatriots or confederates that are taking money to do this and may leave these people, even if they leave them alive, they often go days without water, but are helping undocumented people to get into the country. Where's the interdiction there? Where's the focus and the priority?
Oh, I agree with you. I mean, and you know, this is I'm all for border enforcement and I get it. But border enforcement is also about priority seeking. And what's happening is because people are so desperate to come here and the fears of the wall. But mark my words, there will be no more wall. And the fears of the wall and all sorts of has led them to desperate acts and has meant that the worst of the worst human beings are now in this illicit, you know, sort of trafficking world that someone you just literally cannot get your head around. And I read some of the stories and I have a pretty tough skin. You cannot get your head around the evil that animated the conspiracy. And here would be a tough immigration policy.
Exactly.
Go after them.
Exactly.
Why aren't we going after the employers? Why aren't we going after, you
exactly.
know, I mean, it's, anyway, it's disgusting.
By the way, for those who out there, and I know there's a big back and forth on immigration, for those who don't want Congress to sit down and do something, read the description of what these 100 people in this refrigeration truck with no refrigeration and 100-degree temperature.
Right.
This, you know, I don't know if you ever listened to Ira Glass on the weekend here. I was listening to a story. He did a great story this weekend that people should Google. About your Homer, Alaska, is either of you?
Yeah, I do.
I didn't. I never heard of it. He says you drive 2,500 miles due north from Seattle, then drive 1,200 miles due west to essentially the end of the United States. His producer, Ira Glass's producer, interviews the police chief in Homer. And have you ever had an illegal immigrant, he called it? I don't think he called him an undocumented worker there. No, we haven't. In fact, he said, well, I don't think we've ever even had an immigrant here. Yet in the town, there is this knockdown, drag-out fight over illegal immigration
of course.
Homer, Alaska, where there are no people, no immigrants, legal or otherwise. It's a great piece, and you should go find it.
The genius of it.
So what's Skiff Podcast? There is one
this week.
We have
a really interesting one. I think it will be posted today or tomorrow. I talked a little bit about the cabinet turning against him. I did an interview with the Commandant of the Coast Guard, Admiral Z. Paul Zinkov.
They don't get the credit they deserve.
I know.
They
I thought it would be kind
work.
Of boring. I actually tend not to interview people who are presently serving because they have the talking points. Let's just say... He is not at one with the skepticism of climate change. And we were kind of shocked at how publicly he throws the policies of the administration under the bus. He is the present serving commandant. So we'll post that. We'll probably get a little bit of news out of it. It's the first time he comes out and he deals with the world as he finds it. And he's finding a lot more water out there. So it'll be a good one.
Sounds like a great interview.
When is that up again? When's
it posted? Later today or tomorrow.
What are you going to do with that mug that says?
I'm going to leave it here.
Because
my car is in the service. And so I actually have to take an Uber.
That doesn't mean you don't love it.
I love it. I'm just going to take it when I get. Yeah, I'm not going home now. I'm going to a meeting.
Okay,
bye.
So we'll see you on CNN tonight?
You'll see me on CNN tonight unless, you know, something else happens. And then
when's the first pardon again?
I'm already late by a week.
You are.
This Friday?
Okay, fine.
You still think it's junior?
She just said this Friday.
It's junior.
Okay.
Okay, that's Julia Kayyem. Thanks, Julia.
Julia Kayyem joins us every week. She's the founder of Kayyem Solutions, host of the Skiff podcast, and a CNN and WGBH contributor. Coming up next, a look inside the teenage brain with neuroscientist Frances Jensen. She's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. Andrew Cabral is sitting in for Marjorie Egan. We'll be back later this week. Earlier this month, teenagers, instead of rescuing a man who was drowning, laughed at his struggle to stay afloat while recording it on their phones. It's an act that is utterly devoid of empathy and humanity, an act that betrays a basic human impulse to help a dying man. But could any of their behavior be explained by the developmental stages of their brains? That topic is the subject of Dr. Frances Jensen's book, which explores the science of how the brain grows and why teenagers can be especially impulsive, moody, and not very good at responsible decision-making. Believe me, I know about that. It's entitled The Teenage Brain, A Neuroscientist's Survival Guide to Raising Adolescents and Young Adults. Frances Jensen is professor of neurology and chair of the neurology department at the University of Pennsylvania's Perelman School of Medicine. It's a pleasure to meet you. Thanks so much for being here.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Thanks for joining us. Well, let's start here. Let's start with the science. For people who don't know, explain the science of the teenage brain.
All right. So this science of the teenage brain has only been sort of available in the last 12 years, and it's just emerging year by year. We're getting more and more data across both human studies and animal, you know, experimental studies. So the big news is that the brain, which is our most complex organ, is actually the last organ in the body to mature. It takes until your mid to late 20s to be done. And therefore, these teenagers who look like adults are simply not adults with fewer miles on. They are substantially different. There's two big things that are different about their brains. One is that each brain area is building connections between the brain cells at a much faster rate in childhood and adolescence than in adults. And you actually start off, you have about 100 billion brain cells called neurons, and they make 100 trillion connections called synapses. And that takes the time when most of that's happening is when you're a child and adolescent, because you build, every time you learn something, you build one of these connections. And they have more machinery to do that. You prune unneeded synapses, these connections, as you move into adulthood. So they're actually running with sort of much more highly energized, excitable brains. So that's good because they can learn faster, and studies have shown that they can learn faster, harder, longer, stronger than we can. The paradox is that while they have these highly excitable learning machine brains, they actually are missing some of the connectivity between the different main areas of the brain. And so our brain connects itself. So we have these different regions of our brain, and they have to send signals back and forth on tracks. And the tracks, you have miles of these tracks, obviously, to connect all those brain cells in your brain. And they have to be insulated, just like rubber wire is insulated to produce, to kind of keep an electrical signal going. We have our own fatty substance named myelin, called myelin, that wraps around these long tracks. And that process, these little tiny cells have to begin the process. They begin in the back of the brain and they move forward. So the last place is to really connect with these high-speed connections are in the frontal lobe, the front part of the brain. So let me just say three more things about what we know. The side of the brain has your limbic system, where your impulses come from, and your reward systems and novelty-seeking, risk-taking. That's kind of in the middle of your brain. That gets connected up first before your frontal lobes, which are the seat of executive function, decision-making, empathy, judgment, impulse control, if you get what I'm saying. So they have frontal lobes. They just aren't fully connected yet. So they tend to be very risk-taking with these highly energized brains without a frontal lobe really coming back in real time to quickly tell them, don't do this bad idea. So when I say to adults, last time I checked, we have our frontal lobes and they're connected. We need to think about giving our teenagers frontal lobe assists.
By the way, I know plenty of adults where you wouldn't think they were yet connected, but that's for another segment. We're talking to Dr. Frances Jensen, whose book is The Teenage Brain. By the way, she wrote it with Amy Ellis Nutt. Let's get that in there. So you mentioned the consequence of developing parts of the brain at different speed. The good piece is they're fast learners. That's why, for example, I assume we hear if you're going to learn a language, do it early, that you're shaking your head, you agree with me. Okay, what are the negative consequences of these different layers or timing of development of different parts of the teenage brain?
So it turns out as two big consequences are, well, there's let me tell you one good consequence is the fact that you can do this learning at such a more efficient way in the teen years. It turns out more recent research has shown that you actually can change your IQ in your teen years. And that's newsflash. You can change your IQ in your teen years. And they've done studies between age 10 and 20 looking at verbal IQ and connectivity in the brain. And it can be modified. A third of the people stay the same, a third go down, and a third go up in that window. We can get to that later. So you can imagine how you can modulate that. But because they can make connections so fast, unfortunately, just like learning a language or a fact requires enhancing these connections, unfortunately, addiction, recent brain science has shown, is actually just a form of learning. And it's happening in that limbic system I'm talking about, which is highly connected at that point in development. So actually, teenagers, contrary to myths that say they're just so resilient, are actually more prone to addiction than adults for that reason.
And is that the primary cause of the one-third you just described whose IQ goes down, or is that just one of a number of contributing causes?
One of a number. So stress, substance abuse have been linked to a decrease in IQ, whereas enrichment and learning and reading and things are starting to show that it can increase.
But also another consequence, I guess on the negative, well, I guess you would argue, I don't know if you would argue, why am I speaking for you? You can speak for yourself since you wrote the book. Your emotions they're sort of fully formed, but your ability, you'll respond to that, but your ability to sort of make decisions about what to do with those things are not fully formed. Is that close to accurate?
That is close.
Well, that's
to
the
accurate.
Ultimate nightmare, isn't that?
Well, right. It's like the perfect storm for, say, addiction, because you have these risk-taking brains without like A plus B equals C. Maybe I shouldn't do that. I think there might be a consequence. And in the moment, with the heat of peer pressure around you, you jump impulsively to experiment with something. And so you have that. And moreover, that something, a substance, for instance, will have a greater effect on your brain and you can become addicted more quickly.
So does a teenager, this is really fascinating, we're talking to Frances Jensen about the teenage brain. Does the teenage brain, is there enough capacity in there, even though the connections of the frontal lobe haven't been made or haven't completed or whatever the verb is here? Could you teach a teenager to sort of phony up executive decision making so they can cover for that until it is fully developed?
That is a great point and something that a lot of high schools and colleges and universities are looking into. So the point is that they actually obviously have frontal lobes. They can do really well on their SATs, their ACTs. But when it's called upon with an emotional charge, for instance, to make a decision very quickly, they may not go in the right direction. So hence comes, can you teach them A plus B equals C if it's not going to come immediately to them until their frontal lobes really fully connect? And there's a lot of interest in now using educational institutions to sort of allow for trial and error, maybe virtual reality trial and error, like scenarios of risky situations like, you know, date rape drugs in a bar. What are you going to do if you see it happening? Or what do you do if your friends are goading you to shoplift? What do you say? And teaching them to have the words already in hand. They're great at memorizing things. We know that. And to what extent we can help them think about ahead of time. This is the frontal lobe assist piece of really beginning to sort of teach them, like, okay, if you come into a situation like this, which you might without anybody around you, how would you react? And then maybe some of the time they'll have an answer in their pocket that they'll be able to sort of bring out rather than having to rely on their, you know, potentially patchy ability.
You
to
sound somewhat skeptical
it.
As the ability to do
well,
that
it hasn't
teaching,
been
are you?
Proven yet. I so I, my book is all about facts, and I know a lot of people are experimenting.
That'll get
with
you
this.
Nowhere, by the way, in this age, but it's fine.
So the idea is to, you know, that this may be an opportunity for them.
This strikes me, and I respect the science completely, but the idea of how our brain develops back to front mm-hmm. strikes me as a major design flaw, especially given that it's only been recently that life expectations have grown. We've got, because of advances in science and in medicine, people are living longer. But people in centuries past, to live to 30, you were lucky. If the frontal lobe isn't developed until you're in your 20s, you've only got about 10 good years of good judgment. And so Jim and I were talking about this morning when we were discussing this. So my question is really about a theory. To what degree does social convention or has social convention in years past made up for the fact that they weren't quite there yet? Fear of adults, having to have respect for adults, respect for institutions, respect for conventions before kids became our friends as parents and not our kids, where there was a clear mm-hmm. line. How yeah. much does social convention mm-hmm. make up for whatever yeah. might be lacking
you mean when
biologically?
They were, when teenagers were sent out to work on farms or
yes.
boarding schools.
And they
or
actually
very
did
highly...
it. They stuck around and worked from sun up to sundown.
So there's a lot to unpack in what you've just said. First of all, I've been constantly very concerned and have voiced it that this world, this digitally hyperconnected world where our brains are being, you know, the digital invasion of our brains, if you will, there is a lot more at hand for these teenagers. They schoolyard pranks of yesteryear become, you know, viral events that go global with the same, you know, small trivial impulse that would have just, you know, done a tiny, you know, Polaroid photograph of somebody and put it on a bulletin board. It's not like that anymore.
Right.
So they're playing with fire. And this is something our society has to really get to, you know, to like grapple with. But just to unpack something you said, actually, there is a lot of method in that what might seem madness of the frontal lobe being last on board. It turns out the most elemental parts of your brain, vision, your brain stem, your movement, your motor and sensory systems are those things that are closer to the back. You got to get your basics so you can walk, see, hear, eat, move, breathe. That has to be done first. And that's why you see in development in childhood, the building of language and motor control and coordination. And then the limbic system is on early. And that actually, though, is novelty-seeking behavior, which in a way is what you want, although it is Darwinian, if you will, and mm-hmm. we don't want the negative outcomes in our society,
right.
but it is to probe and get experiential learning. So that's there. And then last is this frontal lobe, simply because probably the real estate is so far to the front that this process just doesn't get there. But it's built in order. And teleologically, there are, you know, anthropologists and others believe that there is a reason to that. Now, I agree that our society is wide open for this 20-something, teens to 20, you know, the 18 to 28 group has a lot more at hand than in prior generations. And I think that's a really important piece.
That's the voice of Dr. Frances Jensen. Her book is The Teenage Brain. The subtitle is really catchy. A Neuroscientist's Survival Guide to Raising Adolescents and Young Adults. But important. Do you ever called as an expert witness in criminal trials?
I have deferred because I wouldn't feel comfortable in that setting.
Okay, well then, just for purposes mm-hmm. of the radio, I mentioned this nauseating situation with these teens laughing while this guy was drowning. We're also a state. How old was O'Brien when he killed Janet Downing in Somerville?
16.
This 16-year-old kid, what, 15, 20 years ago?
Yes, Edward O'Brien.
Killed his next-door neighbor's, his son's best friend's mother, stabbed her 95
yes.
times, as often happens.
And watched her and sort of stalked her a little beforehand.
In legislatures, and correct me, Andrea's a former prosecutor, so she knows much more about this than do I, but they lowered the age at which people must, I guess, be tried as a... as a an adult. And of course, we know even the conservative Supreme Court has said you can't do a mandatory life sentence without at least the possibility of parole. I assume for these reasons, you become the czarina of criminal justice in this country. Craft a criminal justice law that takes into account what you know and write about in terms of the development or non-development of the teenage brain. What should it be?
Well, so there's several things. First of all, I contributed to both the amicus briefs that were led to the Supreme Court.
On the life sentence thing?
On the life sentence.
Oh,
on
goodness.
The two, the one that was proactive and then the second one that was retroactive. And,
right.
You know, as you know, it was in the last 4 or 5 years, both of them have passed. And the point there was that there, it's not that we said that there are certainly people that should not ever be out of on parole, but the fact that everybody is an individual. Now, these life curves that I'm sort of have been implying in, you know, how the brain develops, there are gender differences, with boys being about 2 years behind girls.
Really?
There are early boys and late girls. It's on average. And I think everybody's on their own. What science is now showing is that there's a lot of individual variation on how fast these different parts of the brain, you know, fully mature, if you will. And we don't really even have the science yet to say absolutely mature. In fact, there's evidence to show that into your 30s and 40s, you continue this process of myelination, and this can speed up reaction times and things like that.
That's going to be Donald Trump Jr.'s defense, by the way. He's listening to this show. And, she's a professional. I shouldn't say this in her midst. Go ahead, Doug.
So the point is that there is an opportunity for resiliency if you get it early. Okay, so that there are many if there is the child, because it is a child, somebody under 18, official by definition, could be under the influence of an older sibling who might be over 18 or another very disturbed adult, and that's their peer pressure group, right? So I just told you that peer pressure is something that is unnaturally strong in this age window. It's not unnaturally, it's natural, but it's compared to an adult, it's very strong.
That was part of the defense, by the way, by the younger Tsarnaev,
well,
right here in the federal courthouse in South Boston.
Well, so, I mean, this is why it has to be looked at an individual, because there's two others. Another thing is mental illness also begins to come on in this window, because you have to have at least some part of your sort of frontal lobe and executive function systems connected to actually manifest a genetic predisposition to a depression, to many forms of, say, depression, schizophrenia, bipolar. Not everyone, but you will see that 60 to 80% of people with severe mental illness have their onset between 16 and 26 years of age. So this is a window ripe for the onset of mental illness. So we have to throw that into the equation, too, when we start to evaluate why does somebody do a crime, right? So we have their immaturity, the peer pressure effect, the fact that their limbic systems, when you do functional magnetic resonance imaging on them and you show emotionally charged scenes or engage them in addicting games, things that use that system, their brains turn on twice as strong than children and adults. So they are experiencing emotion in technicolor compared to our black and white. So you have to factor all these things in and then take it to an individual. And
but where does that leave you? Does that leave that legislatures should say we'll give prosecutors discretion to consider, which is what they theoretically do, I guess, the most jurisdictions, to consider the individual, or should there be some guiding legislative principle?
I mean, you have to err on the side, obviously, of public safety. So that's the most paramount thing. You can't let somebody out that if, you know, you can't lead to that uncertainty. But what I'm saying is you have this emotional immaturity, the immaturity of the limbic system, the lack of frontal lobe development is reasoning. You have the possibility of peer pressure and potentially mental illness. These things require help, that can be looked at on an individual basis. Only recently we had advanced functional imaging of the brain to really see these things going on. And it's so not ready for prime time yet in the legal, even though it obviously keeps getting pushed. However, I do think in the next 10 years, we will develop sort of an app to, you know, figure out where somebody is on this developmental journey when they combine functional imaging. Not everybody's going to get but we'll be able to use that as a tool to understand and dissect out what's going on.
But both of you are talking about this as though, whether it's, you know, ready or not right now, you're talking about it only in terms of sentencing. Why wouldn't this be used to shift the burden in a prosecution? Why wouldn't it become not an affirmative defense that my brain was undeveloped and here are the experts that have examined, you know, me or my client and to tell you that, but that the the burden shifts to the prosecution, there is a presumption that a teenage brain is not fully developed, and therefore you have to, in terms of proving criminal responsibility and all of those other things, or at least even the specific intent for certain crimes, the requisite mens rea, that burden should be on the prosecution to prove that. Why wouldn't a prosecution have to prove that you were capable, in terms of your own brain development, of formulating the intent to commit this crime?
Yeah, I think we can't. The science isn't ready for prime time yet. That's the problem. I think that we also have to imagine what our society, and again, all the digital signals that are coming at these kids and the kinds of stressors they can see. Look at ISIS. ISIS preys on this window of development for obvious reasons. They're impressionable. They'll just do it. And those people may not have started out as potential jihadists, but by the time they've been to the website and got pulled in, this is a time when they're probing, they're risk takers, they're novelty seeking, and they're pressing, like ISIS presses all the buttons to lure, you know, them in. So we have to kind of think of this as like our society is creating opportunities maybe that in the past were not as prevalent. They were always there, but it's a very complicated.
So, Francis, are we potentially, you said, let's say in a decade, for argument's sake, let's say in a decade, are we going to see Barry Scheck calling in a doctor, I'm serious, with that imaging that says the reason you cannot convict my client is because look at that image and you can see that the development is such that he or she, well, you know the end of the sentence. Or is that where this is going?
Well, hasn't that already happened?
Well, the same goes for mental illness, right? I mean, an adult with mental illness. So I think this neuroscience is moving in the direction of giving us a better understanding of detecting this. And of course, this then brings us to, you know, we need better screening for mental illness in our society. 1 in 4 people have, you know, that's some form of psychiatric disorder. And this is actually a window when many, like 60 to 80% of people who will have a lifelong psychiatric condition are having their onset in this window. And I've been working with NIH and HHS about talking about, you know, figuring out a better way to screen these populations before the end of high school so that you can at least, you know, we screen for everything else. We screen for colon cancer, breast cancer, prostate cancer. We're not screening for an incredibly prevalent disease set that is emerging in this window.
Thank goodness we're cutting 20% out of the National Institutes of Health. Now,
exactly.
Last thing from me, at least. So we're giving advice to the criminal justice system. There are thousands of parents out there who either have teenagers or teenagers to be. Based upon your research and the book Teenage Brain, give them a few pointers as to what they should do to sort of counter or at least transition through this period you described. What do they do?
And before you answer that, isn't part of the reason that you wrote the book is because you have two teenage sons and you were trying to figure it out?
I was wrote the book in my own self-defense of getting through this. No, I mean, you know, as I say, I was doing brain development research actually at Children's Hospital here in Boston.
Oh, really?
I was a neurologist at Children's and at the Brigham, and then I moved to Penn just 5 years ago. So I was happily doing this work in my lab, and then I realized I had an experiment going on in my own home, which are my two teenage sons, and it was like, oh my God. So, and I really just delved into the literature. This was sort of in the mid 2005, 2006, 2007 window, and it was just emerging, and it really helped me understand. So, one of the things I thought, just I hope some of the points that I made today so far, that their synapses are developing more quickly, they can take advantage of this, their IQ can go up, but it's a double edged sword because substances and addiction can catch hold, but also that they're more emotionally sort of active without the benefit of their modulating frontal lobe. So this, even just saying that to parents, I think helps them step back and go, okay, it's not me. This is not unique. This too shall pass. And to sort of stay close to your teenager, to not alienate them. And the worst thing I think to do is to, for instance, I'll give you an example. Your teenage daughter comes in, you know, in tears at the end of a day saying, somebody wore the exact same outfit as I did at school. I'm devastated and in tears. And you look at the child and your impulse would be, this is not an international incident. You know, what's the big deal? If you were to actually, research has shown that similar things, functional MRIs done during somebody seeing an emotional stimulus as a teenager, their brains turn on for things like this, as if it was an to the same extent your brain would turn on if you heard about news from Korea or something. So with an international incident. So you have to realize they really are in a different place. They're probing And I think that this society, we have to be a little bit, you know, careful that we have a lot out there that they can sample, that even in our childhoods, we did not have that range. And that this could be...
You mean because the internet, social media,
yes,
all that sort
and,
of stuff.
Yes, and this is where I say the frontal
lobe
assist.
Even beyond what their parents know about, and they're really communicating with one another.
Right. And there's a lot of opportunity for cyberbullying and a lot of impulsivity going back and forth. This is the window, right? So to bear that in mind and sort of stay, don't ridicule your child. I think there's a lot of ridicule out in society. Oh, stupid teenagers. And I'm deeply respectful of where they're going through. And I give talks to schools and tell them that, and they're fascinated because, of course, they're searching for their own identity at this point. So any help to explain to them why they did that stupid thing on Saturday night, too, they're welcoming, like, oh, that's why. So I would say stay close. Don't alienate. Don't meddle too much. Don't be helicopter. But model yourself as a role model. And when it comes to decision making, the college process, the college search process, getting ready for the next school year, these are even in high school, these are great opportunities for parents to interact and say, so what's our checklist today? You know, what are you going to do to get ready for, you know, the start of 10th grade? Or, you know, how are you going to approach, really sort of start working? This is what summer is actually ideal for. And I would say, because we know they have this ability to learn, we call it plasticity, meaning the brain can mold itself to experience and the synapses, you know, if you can learn a skill, your brain can be molded differently than somebody else learning another skill. This is a time to address unique strengths and weaknesses. So if you are really strong in something, use the summer to even get better at it. But if you're weak in something that really matters, you better get some – you can use this time to do some extra classes or get some remedial work. This is a really wonderful time that we don't tend to use enough. And I feel for parents, given the season right now, it's the middle of a rainy, you know, July day, maybe head off to an interesting experience where you're a teenager, work on their – what is their reading list? What are they doing? Help shore them up.
I'm sure every single parent like me who has 20-something children is saying, where were you when I needed you? That's what we're saying. It's a pleasure to meet you. This book is great, and thanks for your time.
Thanks
we
for
really
joining
appreciate
us.
It.
Great. Thank you.
Dr. Francis Jensen is a professor of neurology and chair of the neurology department at the University of Pennsylvania's Perelman School of Medicine. Her book is entitled The Teenage Brain, A Neuroscientist's Survival Guide to Raising Adolescents and Young Adults. Francis Jensen, it was great to talk to you. Coming up, Bob Thompson gives us his verdict on OJ's televised parole hearing. That and more is next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
He's Jim Browdy.
And she's Marjorie Egan.
And this is 89.7 WGBH, WGBH HD1, Boston.
Online at WGBHnews.org.
Boston's local NPR.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. Andrew Cabral sitting in for Marjorie Egan. Sean Spicer will probably go down as the worst White House press secretary in U.S. history ever, period. But he also may go down as giving us some of the most memorable television ever, period.
This was the largest audience to ever witness an inauguration, period.
Yes, I believe that we have to be honest with the American people. I think sometimes we can disagree with the facts. I mean, just the other day, he sat down with Martin Luther King Jr. And you don't get to just yell out questions. We're going to raise our hand like big boys and girls. You've got Russia. If the president puts Russian salad dressing on his salad tonight, somehow that's a Russian connection.
I would like to begin today by apologizing on behalf of you to me for how you have treated me these last 2 weeks. And that apology is not accepted. Because I'm not here to be your buddy. I'm here to swallow gum, and I'm here to take Nate.
Oh, boy. I'm going to miss them both. Joining us online to talk about this and other TV news is Bob Thompson. Bob's professor and founding director of the Bleier Center for TV and Popular Culture at the Newhouse School of Public Communications at Syracuse. Good afternoon, Bob. How are you?
Very well. How about you guys?
Excellent. Thank you.
Hi, Bob. It's Andrea Cabral. It's nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you too.
So I've got three guesses as to who your worst is this week, and the first two don't count.
Right. Well, this one's, I guess, kind of a career worst, even though it was a short career as a press secretary. But I think when you said the worst at the job ever, period, that might be a pretty accurate statement. So comedians are going to miss him.
Yes.
This is horrible. I'm forgetting the name of the woman who plays Sean Spicer on SNL.
Oh, Melissa McCarthy.
Melissa McCarthy. Isn't she nominated for a couple Emmys for her portrayal?
Yeah, she had that down. Now she's going to have to. Of course, you know, just because Sean Spicer stepped down doesn't mean he can't come back on Saturday Night Live.
If he had a sense of humor and if he really wanted to make some sort of small recovery from all of this, if he appeared as himself on Saturday Night Live, it would go a long way to rehabilitating what shreds of dignity he has left.
Yeah, Sarah Palin did that. She went on Saturday Night Live. So a lot of them do that. I kind of doubt he will, but...
Also, didn't he say on the way out the door, I think he said on the day he resigned, he used the M word. Was it malicious? I think you described Melissa McCarthy's characterization as malicious, and you would think if you're paving your way into the dreaded private sector that you'd be saying something to show you have a sense of humor, but there's no evidence that he does have a sense of, even though I would have to say, Bob, I hate to project your worst than advice in advance, but I have to say, I think the new director of communications has potential to be really funny down the line, don't you think?
Oh, yeah, I think so, too. So we haven't had a whole lot of time to see, but I think there's a lot of raw material there. By the way, we not only lost the voice of the president and Sean Spicer last week, the voice of Kermit the Frog as well.
I know.
And the
that's
Henson
a horrible
family
controversy.
Seems to be on board with that.
Yeah, you know, I don't quite understand that whole story. I mean, it's this big scandal, but it's based on there's so little detail of what this guy has actually been doing that's so offensive for so long.
They keep referring to it vaguely as his business behavior, his conduct in personal businesses with which he's involved.
Exactly, which is it's pretty vague.
Yeah.
Well, I think
it's hard to become truly outraged at that charge.
Well, it sounds like it's a long simmering thing, too. Yeah. But you figure there's got to be something. I think Sean Spicer is probably involved in that, too, actually. So what is your best of the week there, Bob Thompson?
Well, Netflix introduced yet another series on Friday called Ozark. Mm. And Jason Bateman and Laura Linney. And it looked like it was going to be a yet another one of these families getting tied up in crime and all the rest of it. And I grudgingly went to it, and three episodes in was completely taken by it. So that's Ozark on Netflix. There's 10 episodes.
We have a little sound. Here's the show's patriarch, Marty Bird, explaining to his wife their getaway plan now that the cartel who he's laundering money for has killed his business partner for siphoning off money. Listen.
Now, here's what I'm going to do. Over the next 2 days, I'm going to try to pull together $8 million to pay back what Bruce stole.
Do we even have that much?
Well, it's going to be tight. I mean, after early withdrawal penalties, I don't know, but I'm going to try. What we're not going to do, though, is panic, okay? We're just going to prioritize, and we're going to compartmentalize, and there's going to be a little bit of time management, okay? All right, starting first thing tomorrow morning after we tell the kids that we're moving. We're going to call your friend Linda, the realtor, and we're going to list the house. And then you're going to call the moving company. And then you and the kids are going to pack. You can either help them or just let them do it themselves. I don't really care. But come Friday after school, we're on the road. Okay, that's it.
You know, I'm not a huge Jason Bateman fan. I'll give it a chance. Laura Linney is one of the best actresses on the planet. I don't know if you remember The Big C, which really never got the juice that it deserved about having cancer. But, you know, I haven't seen it yet. But it seems to have a Breaking Bad-ish theme to it, does it not?
It gets compared to Breaking Bad a lot. I'm always reluctant to compare anything to Breaking Bad.
Yeah,
you know how the special place I put that. But it storyline wise, it's a similar kind of thing. It's a family and they're in all kinds of trouble. And in his case, it's money laundering, not meth making. The difference, however, is that the whole family knows what's going on by the second episode, mm-hmm. whereas in Breaking Bad, it would that wasn't the case.
I'm looking forward to this. I actually saw both of them on, I think it was Good Morning America yesterday, and I actually like Jason Bateman a lot because I love Arrested Development, and I've liked some of the other things that he's been on. But he directed some of these as well.
He directed the first one, which is usually the most important. So, yeah, he's involved in this behind the camera as well as in front of it.
So let's move on to a show that one of the things I love about this in advance is this is a show that hasn't been written, hasn't been filmed, virtually nothing except concept, and already it's one of the most controversial shows to be. This is Confederate. Tell us about it, Bob.
Right. Well, HBO announced that Confederate is in their plans, and the reason it's such a big story, of course, is because it's by the people who did Game of Thrones. So this is going to be what they do after Game of Thrones. The other reason it's such a big story is the premise is that it's an alternative reality, sort of like Philip Roth's Plot Against America or Man in the High Castle.
Yeah.
And in this case, the Confederate states won the Civil War. The institution of slavery went into more modern times, and this series is supposedly begins as we're moving toward the third American Civil War. Needless to say, there were a lot of people who took some issues with this on Twitter.
I'm one of them. I didn't take. I probably did say something about it on Twitter. I can't find words to say how bad an idea I think this is.
Why?
And comparing it to The Man in the High Castle is completely, they're an opposite. We're really clear that during World War II that Nazism was a bad thing, and it's external to us as a country. Why on earth would we want to see, we've already had Confederate States of America, that show was already on.
That's right, that was back in what, 2004?
Yes. Why are we revisiting this with the idea, first of all, because we're still, you know, in some places in this country, very many places, very ambivalent about who was right and who was wrong in the Civil War. So why are we undertaking a show where there may not be a clear villain?
But you don't know that. How do you know they're not going to? I mean, I'm not a big Game of Thrones fan because I'm not big into rape and violence. So there's no indication that they're going to treat this sensitively. But we don't know that they're not going to treat it sensitively.
The way that
right?
you know that, Jim,
what's that?
Is that they're making the assumption that the institution of slavery would exist in 2017, that as an institution, it would exist in this country and we'd be good with it. That tells me that you don't know where the villains
are. Wait a second. Where's the good with it part of it? Oh, you mean that a sector of the population?
Right. They're saying that that the Confederate States won back during the Civil War, and it is now 2017, and we still haven't kind of gotten to the point of saying, you know, maybe this isn't such a good thing.
You know, Bob, speaking of not such a good thing, were it not for the fact that the guys who are behind this are the biggest success ever on HBO, which makes me sad in light of the fact that they have more viewers than The Sopranos had, is it possible this thing never sees the light of day, or they're too big to stop?
Well, I think, this controversy was pretty loud in the first announcement, and the fact that it has not gone anywhere yet. I don't think there's any investment yet. I don't think anything's written. I don't think I'm going to cast anybody. They're not even going to start thinking about it, I don't think, until they've finished the final Game of Thrones season. So this balloon they floated, even though HBO already has given this a go-ahead, who knows where it could go? And I find it impossible to have a very much of a conversation about it because we know absolutely nothing about it except that these two people are involved, as well as Nichelle Spellman, who did Justified, and Malcolm Spellman, who did Empire. And I've got to think that they would bring a voice to it that would mitigate some of the things that people are worried about. But it's I don't know. It's so hard to say anything about something that we not only do we not know anything about. I think they know very little about it yet.
Now, Andrea, does it make you feel any better that OJ may be available to star in this or play one of the lead roles, or that doesn't allay any of your concerns?
It allays none of my concerns. Any television show that assumes that, you know, what would it be like if the Confederacy had won the war is not going to ever fly with me.
Okay, so let's
Well, I think there's two timing issues, too, and some of the comedians made fun about this. Most of the comedians told the joke pretty, they would describe the Confederacy, and then they would say, oh, that's, wait another year and it'll be a documentary. That was the big one-liner
right.
that came
well,
out of this.
Well, you know, Jeff Sessions is the AG.
Okay.
And then the other timing thing was that WGN had a show we've talked about before
yeah.
called Underground,
yeah.
and that got canceled. So I think a lot of people didn't like the idea that from the ashes of Underground, this is what what comes up.
That's a good point.
We're talking to Bob Thompson. So I touched on the OJ thing. 240 media organizations sought, I don't know how he got him, media credentials. It was live streamed virtually everywhere. I'm embarrassed to admit we were watching it live while we were on the air doing a live radio show. What does this portend post-October 1st there, Bob Thompson?
Well, we'll have to see. But I think given the amount of attention that it got on television, it's true. Everybody was carrying it live. There were specials and all of that kind of thing. I don't think it came anywhere near proportionately penetrating the culture in general. I walked into my class on the morning of the thing and said, today's the O.J. Parole hearing. And one person said, oh, is that today? And
wow.
Another had virtually no idea it was happening. When that O.J. verdict was read, I had students piled outside my office to look at the TV screen when it was happening. None of that happened. And even me, last week, I'd forgotten that this thing was coming. Instead of saying what to watch being the O.J. parole thing, I think I said we should be watching Michael Phelps racing a great white shark. By the way, I now formally apologize to you and your listeners for suggesting.
By the way, my favorite analysis of this, obviously later in the day, Marjorie and I both got to see the video of Simpson's performance. Jeffrey Toobin, who I love anyway, CNN's legal analyst, and obviously the author of Run of His Life, The People versus O.J. Simpson, his line, seeing this, meaning Simpson's own performance at this parole hearing, just reinforces a belief that he is a deeply delusional and self-obsessed narcissist, and good luck to America when he is let out. I mean, I could not agree more with every single word that Toobin uttered. Good luck to America when he's out.
Bob, do you think that getting a chance to see him, there were so many people that were very young, actually, when the verdict came down in the murder case. Do you think people getting a chance to see him at 70 years old talking about himself and his lack of criminal life the way he did? Do you think conflict-free life? Do you think that that penetrated at all? And you know, the pundits certainly were on TV talking about it. But what do you think the reaction to O.J. Simpson was?
Well, I think for people who don't remember the verdict and the whole Bronco chase and that whole the first two acts of this story, I think they were much more brought to it by that ESPN 10-part thing and the FX movie. Not that every one of them saw that, but I think that was the reintroduction of O.J. or the introduction of the O.J. Simpson story to a lot of people who simply weren't around or conscious at the time it happened. I'm not sure if you sat down and watched this, especially that moment with the hot mic while they were waiting that was really telling in that it was so that I think was the most interesting part of the whole broadcast. But as many news organizations as were covering these, I think most of the people who weren't around when the whole O.J. thing happened the first time were probably not watching this. Okay.
So if you're a network or you're Netflix or whoever you are you willing to take the incredible blowback you're going to get by negotiating with this guy to do something, a podcast, a reality series, a something? Do you take that chance, or you just say, I'm not going to do this?
I don't think Netflix would touch it. I don't think ABC, CBS, or NBC would touch it. I don't think Bravo would do they'll do Real Housewives, but I don't think they're going to do this. But the difference is that since he's been behind bars, the venues in which you can do things have so expanded.
Exactly.
He even alluded to this a bit during his testimony or answering questions, whatever you call it, that he could do a blog or something like that. Even if nobody touches him, there's nothing to keep him from doing his own YouTube channel.
Well, remember, Trump was going to do his own channel if he had not won. Right, exactly.
Well, remember the blowback to the book If I Did It?
Yeah.
And what happened with the publisher there? And
you know who owns it now?
Who?
Ron Goldman's father wanted his part of the settlement, and he has... I don't quite understand this. Maybe you do, Bob. But Fred Goldman, obviously, he has either published or printed the cover with the word "if" minuscule,
yes.
So that the "I did it" or the readable letters.
Right. He completely had that covered redesigned with exactly as you described. And of course, that's true. OJ, they can't touch his pension stuff. Right. But he's got a lot to pay down on those civil things. And anything, you know, he would do on television or a reality show or whatever would supposed to go to that.
That's a good
although
point.
It seems like there are always ways to get around it.
We're talking to Bob Thompson from Syracuse.
So, Bob, I'm interested to get your take on this, on this Doctor Who thing. I admittedly have never really watched. I think maybe in my whole life I've watched maybe one Doctor Who just to see what it was about. But this idea that it's finally broken the glass ceiling by having the first female Doctor Who, I'm wondering what your take is. I mean, it's 2017, and the fact that this is such a huge deal. I realize, you know, it's one of the BBC's longest-running shows, if not the longest. But my question is, what took you so long?
Well, we got a female Doctor Who quicker than we got a female president.
But I'm Bob. Thank you.
Thank you, Bob.
But I agree. It seems to me that, especially since the premise of Doctor Who is that, for one thing, it's a fantasy. You can do whatever you please, and the Doctor, if he can come back in different bodies, there's nothing keeping that from coming into a female body. But even in 2017, with this announcement, there's a lot of people who are very upset about it, which kind of surprised me. I would have thought that the audience of Doctor Who would have been more open to that kind of thing. But the nice news about this is that the BBC announced that the actor who's going to be playing the new Doctor Who is actually going to be paid the same amount as the previous male Doctor Who. And in the BBC, that's actually big news because they're reeling over the announcement that the highest paid female celebrity there makes a quarter of what the highest paid male starts.
Well, also, I read this weekend that Robin Wright still doesn't make as much as Kevin Spacey in House of Cards, which is pretty amazing. Can I just throw out an aside? The woman who is it Jodie Whittaker? Is that her name?
Yes.
Who's going to be
yes.
doing Doctor Who is, I don't know if we've ever discussed this with you, Broadchurch is one of the best things on television. And
absolutely.
I would argue Olivia Colman, who's one of the leads, is one of the greatest actors that I've ever seen.
And her male co-star is a former Doctor Who.
Oh, that's exactly
yes.
right. Oh, that's exactly
yes.
right. Yeah,
it's a great show.
Do you like Broadchurch, I hope, Bob?
I do, and I can't believe in all these years we've never talked about it. But yeah, I agree with everything you just said.
Let's add it to next week's list. So what are we watching this coming week there, Bob Thompson?
Amazon on Friday starts The Last Tycoon. I don't know if this is going to be any good, but I'm giving it a what to watch because I really like that unfinished novel. And because it's unfinished, I guess a TV version might give me something to finish it.
This is Fitzgerald, for those who don't know. And here's a clip from the trailer for The Last Tycoon.
I want to start doing what MGM's doing. They're the only shop in town making any money.
It's my movie, Pat.
We make a product, Monroe. There has to be someone to buy it.
I have great stories. Got one about this band leader who's
I'm
going to...
I'm excited to hear it after you've graduated.
Wayne DeMarco Taft.
I need a percentage.
They put me out of business.
I'm making our movie.
With whose money?
You know what troubles me about this? This is going to aggravate a lot of people because everybody loves him. Kelsey Grammer is the lead in this. Is Louis Mayer? Is that who he's sort of playing?
Is
that...
Yeah.
Yeah.
The name is... I think Pat Brady, but yeah, he's one of those moguls.
Does that give you pause at all, or does it not? I know Frasier was one of the most beloved.
Did you see Boss?
No.
Did you ever see?
No, I never even heard of it.
You watch Boss.
With Kelsey Grammer?
Boss was on, was it on
Listen
Hulu?
To you.
I don't know if it was on, Bob, maybe you know this. Kelsey Grammer did a show. It only lasted for two or three seasons.
Yeah, where was that on?
Called Boss. It was
remember.
Either on Netflix. I think it might have been Netflix, but it could have been Hulu. He was superb, and he played the mayor of Chicago, and it was more House of Cards than House of Cards, only a local Chicago version, and it was outstanding.
Really? It was on Stars, by the way.
Oh, Stars, I'm sorry.
Stars.
Wow.
Yeah.
If you've not seen this, you really should see it.
You know, Bob, before you go, is anything F. Scott, I probably should know, is anything F. Scott Fitzgerald did ever been made into a television thing, or is this it?
Oh, let's see. There's been several Gatsby film adaptations.
Sure.
You know, I can't think of one right off the top of my head, but I'm pretty sure there must have been at least one of the stories or something. I'll look into that and get back to you right after our Broadchurch conversation.
Fair enough, Bob. It's a pleasure to talk to you, as always.
Thanks,
we really appreciate your time.
Bob
always
Thompson.
Fun. Thank you.
Bob Thompson joins us every week. He's the founding director of the Bleier Center for Television and Popular Culture and a trustee professor of television and popular culture at the Newhouse School of Public Communications at Syracuse. Bob Thompson, it was great to talk to you. Coming up, we're going to get Reverends Irene Monroe and Emmett Price's take on the police shooting in Minneapolis and the role reversal where we have a black officer shooting and killing a white bystander. That conversation is next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Brady, Andrew Cabral sitting in for Marjorie. Here is Studio 3 to take on some of the moral dilemmas of the day. Reverends Irene Monroe and Emmett Price. Irene is a syndicated religion columnist. Emmett is a professor and founding executive director of the Institute for the Study of the Black Christian Experience at Gordon-Conwell Theological Seminary. Reverends Emmett Price and Irene Monroe, welcome back. Good to see you both.
Thanks for having us back.
And glad to be here.
Hi, guys. How are you?
Doing well. How about yourself?
Good to see you.
Very good.
And
nice to see you, too.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much. We're really happy with the show. So about 6 days ago, as I'm sure you know, a white woman from Australia in Minneapolis was shot by a black police officer. She was apparently calling 911. She thought that there might be a sexual assault going on in the alley behind her home. She called 911, apparently approached the patrol car as it when it pulled up, and ultimately ended up being shot by the driver, by the passenger, the officer in the passenger side, who was a black police officer. While everybody absolutely agrees that yet another killing of an unarmed citizen or civilian is a deeply tragic thing. It's been striking, and we talked about this Sunday on BPR Weekend. Mm-hmm. Marcela Garcia and I talked about it. The different responses, and there's been a different response literally from every single faction that ordinarily responds to a police shooting, whether the person's unarmed or armed. Each of them has responded differently than the way that they would ordinarily do that. So starting with you, Irene, and then to you, Emmett, let's unpack that a little bit.
Well, yeah, I think what's been very, very interesting here is that you really begin to see how race plays in the response of this.
So starting first with the police, there was a federation of police. I'm not sure if it was local or national, but starting first with the typical, the police response was, so Emmett would be better for that. So the police, starting first with the, let's unpack the individual responses. The police mm-hmm. response, give us the police response to this case versus what you ordinarily hear.
Well, the police response to this case is that the chief of police, Janae Hartu, I believe is the way that her name, you know, immediately said that this was horrific. This was, tragic. It should not have happened, she said. And then she also kind of suggested that we want to hear Officer Noor speak, right? And then after all of the pushback on her, she resigned.
That's right.
Right?
Yeah.
Because she didn't even come back for the thing for, 3 days or something.
I mean, she, so the notion of the police chief almost taking the side with the white woman as opposed to backing her officer is a new spin on a lot of these things. And let's not forget that this occurrence in Minneapolis is essentially 5 miles from St. Anthony, Minnesota, where the Philando Castile situation happened, both in Minnesota. And so dynamically, Irene's right about the race piece because you have a Somalian-American officer who has been, described as black. And the common thread is that in all of these scenarios, the black person is the one who, in essence, gets character assassinated. Yeah. So now they're going into his files and they're trying to suggest, and some people on one side of the polar notion of what not is talking about his Islamic faith and that he's an Islamic supremacist.
I have to say, I have never, ever seen a police officer's well, let's start here. There have been other police shootings where we didn't even know the identity of the police officer for days or even weeks. But I've certainly never seen that an Episcopalian shot a civilian or a Catholic or a Baptist
or an atheist or whatever.
Or an agnostic. An agnostic police officer shot someone. Right. And that was such a huge departure. Yeah. I mean, it said Muslim, Somali Muslim was in the headline.
Well, I want to say just a little more about the racial component. So you got the racial component, which is very, very obvious. But I also say there's the gender component to it as well. I mean, she is the chief of police here. And I think she understood that it would come down on her much heavier than it would her male brethren. I think that she clearly understood that.
Do you still think, but she, you think that her response in sort of appearing to side with the victim in this case was because she felt as though she would take a harder hit as a female police officer than a male officer would.
She went into damsel in distress. Similarly to the police officer, and I think it was in Kentucky, she was a white woman, and she was just recently acquitted of her charges. I can't remember her name. There's so many that happened, it's hard to keep track of it. But again, I do think that there is a component of gender here in terms of how she will be perceived and respected, or even can come back, come back from this.
I can't speak to that because that would be dangerous on my side to suggest that it's not. But she she made a huge classic mistake as a manager.
Yeah.
She threw her officer under the bus. She stated, and this is, and I quote, "I believe the actions in question go against who we are as a department, how we train, and the expectations we are as a department. These were the actions of one individual."
Yeah.
I mean, she isolated her officer and threw him under the bus and tried to, keep the rest of the department clear.
It really is.
Yeah, it literally never happens. Yeah. Now, on the other side, there were lots of people saying, and keep in mind, the Washington Post, because the FBI's Bureau of Justice Statistics actually keeps statistics on this, but only when police departments voluntarily give them over. The Washington Post, as of, I think, last year, possibly the year before, started keeping track of police shootings. So we're at about 660 police shootings thus far this year. We're on track to meet the number that we had last year, which was 1,000. But of that number, 29, including this particular woman, have been unarmed people. And what you did hear people say was, where are the protests for her?
Right.
Because it's still an unarmed person. It shouldn't be only an unarmed black person that people protest about. The fundamental question is about whether or not this constitutes an unprecedented level of police brutality that's unacceptable on any level. And there's a point to that. What's your reaction to that? There were
protests. I mean, there was, and whether they were mediaized or not is the challenge, right? But there were protests. There were protests in Minneapolis. There were also protests in other larger cities. Because let's remember, Black Lives Matter movement and some of the movements associated with Black Lives Matter are not all black people.
There are a lot
of young white college students, a lot of young white liberals and progressives who are part of those movements. And they have been moving en masse on all of these situations, including this last one.
See, but I think this is again where I feel like you see the nexus of gender as well as race here. I think that the lack of protest has a lot to do with the fact that I think white people feel that justice will be done. That's number one. And I think that the reason that we go out, meaning people of color, is that justice won't be meted. We won't reach
that
level.
That's a very good point.
So I think that we will, the whole idea is that let the system do what the system does best. And so I don't think that it's about, well, she's a white woman, we're not going to go out and protest. It's about the laws were already made to protect you. So we're going to let it run its course and you expect a good outcome. We never do.
Let's talk about a place, though, where they're not allowing. I'm sorry.
No, I was just going to say that. I was just going to remind the audience that we have Emmett Price and Reverend Irene Monroe here.
You know, I wish Marjorie was here for this because she is Fox News obsessed. But there are reports, which I think says a lot and almost all you need to know. Fox News on the day of this event reported on it 11 times. Six times they mentioned that the shooter was a Somali American. Mm-hmm. On the same day in Texas, a white cop was indicted for killing a black teenager. White cop, black teenager.
No,
Fox News didn't mention it one time news report in 24 hours. Yeah, but it isn't only a question about, I don't know if it's never, you say it's never, I accept what you say, but the juxtaposition on the same day of what they reported ad nauseum. And believe me, I'm not saying that what happened in Minnesota is not newsworthy, but that they didn't report it all in Texas. And as you said at the beginning of this discussion, mentioning repeatedly, there was a Somali American. Obviously, I think it's pretty clear.
And part of the way agenda that was. Part of the way he's been mentioned is as a diversity hire. Right. And so he's been chronicled right. in the media as the diversity hire. And the irony is that the Minneapolis mayor, Betsy Hodges, had actually given him a commendation on for his great work in not only representing the Somali American community, but actually being a superstar officer.
But what I what's very interesting I thought about this is that the lack of support that he receives, you know, from his department and certainly department chief, it's really no different than what's here in Brookline. Again, that while
those two cops, yeah, right. I interviewed
ultimately left the department,
right? Yeah. And I corroborate with Emmett in that it is perceived even by the larger audience and population that this is a diversity hire. He doesn't know what he's doing. He wasn't brought into the Brotherhood here and stuff, and so she can easily throw him under the bus, because in many ways, I don't think he was ever incorporated.
Yeah, but let me just say, I'm 90% sure, just to provide a little balance on the mayoral front, I think I'm right about this, and you'll correct me if I'm wrong. I believe the mayor immediately after it cautioned against a backlash against the Somali American community.
That's correct.
Which apparently is not small, which I think is a pretty important thing to do. So there were some actions, not many, that were responsible here. We're talking about Price.
This proves a couple of points. One of which is that we always like to talk about, and it's interesting because whenever this happened, we'll say, oh, that's an anomaly. We have a lot of great cops. I didn't hear that narrative following itself. One of the things that bothered me, too, is that we don't get at the ideology that really shapes policing in this society, in this culture here. And so I think that while we always see it in a sort of a black-white dynamic, I think we will see more of that because of the ideology behind policing is toxic.
Now, I agree. And I think that as opposed to being able to delve into each of these questions and really get some serious answers and ask ourselves, we're not going to do that. We're going to take it as the exception that proves the rule, which we've decided to accept. So moving from that to you both are familiar, I'm sure, with Game of Thrones.
Oh, yeah. It premiered
good
last
show.
Week. Yeah,
good show.
Yeah, yeah.
But the two showrunners,
Game of Thrones
is fantastic.
Oh, my God.
I don't like it. Even though it's high fantasy, I don't like the violence against women. People of color are in subordinate roles. So it really sort of re-inscribes this kind of power dynamic. I mean, name someone or a group of people of color there that have a powerful position.
Well, I think I mean, I don't know that. Well, do we have time to do this?
No.
Okay. The dragon's
really,
black.
Okay. All right. Well, next time I'm on, let's have a debate about Game of Thrones, because I actually think it's more regional. This color of the skin of the people has to do with where they live. I do, and I don't necessarily agree with you that there aren't any people of color in.
No, they are, but they're not in powerful position. I do see this in this season.
I guess we are having this discussion.
Women are ascending to a much more powerful and visible position now, but it still doesn't negate the portrayal of women.
It's also like rape television.
Yeah, thank you.
I mean, really. But in any case,
that's right, glorified.
Why don't we leave that one?
I think it's funny when people say it's rape television.
It is.
When no matter where you look throughout history, and especially in whatever time frame
medieval,
this is supposed to be,
period, that
rape
Martin's
drives wars. Rape is considered a spoil of war. Rape is endemic to the way that we live. And so saying that television ought not to reflect that is a reality doesn't make sense.
I've only watched a couple of times, I have to say, and I watched the first one I saw was The Red Wedding.
You can't start with The Red Wedding.
Well, I happen to see that.
I'm surprised you're not in therapy. How did you start with The Red Wedding?
Who says I'm not?
Right.
Okay, so let's move on to The Confederate.
I have to say, Outlander is just much better. I mean, if you want all of that, just Outlander.
Okay, obviously.
Just making casting.
Go ahead. So what is your point exactly?
The two guys, the showrunners, David Benioff and D.B. Weiss, were the showrunners for Game of Thrones, are considering, and apparently somewhere down the road, to getting a new HBO show off the ground called Confederate, according to this description, Confederate takes place in a grisly dystopia where America's southern states successfully seceded from the Union, quote, giving rise to a nation in which slavery remains legal and has evolved into a modern institution. I'm not sure what they mean here, because if they seceded from the Union, they would be their own country versus having a North and a South, and this seems to contemplate a North and a South in one country. But in any event, what's your take on this?
Well, there's two things here. I think it plays a rather concrete sort of American fantasy that really bothers me. It raises a couple of questions. You know, is it politically incorrect to depict American slavery, you know, in a playful and entertainment way? But then is there a politically correct way to do it? And I think what it reminds me of, I mean, this was a couple of years ago when we had Django Unchained. Do you remember that?
Oh, absolutely.
And the controversy. And the whole thing is that was really an action, you know, sort of movie where, you know, Jamie Foxx, who plays Django, gets his woman. But I think this is what bothers me. I think that American slavery continues to be this sort of difficult topic to talk about. We avoid it at any and every cost, particularly if it's not spun to white appeal. And I think that as a society that we would rather sit in a dark theater for 2+ hours watching an entertainment film about American slavery than just voluntarily sit face-to-face and have the needed conversation about race that we've been talking
about.
Well,
that's a given, isn't it? Where are you on this thing?
Well, I think people who like to complain will find anything to complain about. I want to see the show, and then I'll tell you what I think about it.
Well I'm actually, as I said, when we were discussing with Bob Thompson, so I'm sort of where Emmett is here. You are surely not, Andrew.
No,
why don't you throw your two cents in?
People just tuned in. I feel very, very strongly that the comparing it to Man in the High Castle. Have you seen Man in the High Castle?
Mm-hmm. I have. Okay. Yeah.
Here's the difference.
You should explain what it is.
If the Nazis had won. The Man in the High Castle is what would our world look like if the Nazis had won. In World War II, the Nazis were the clear villains. In this country, it is not clear to too many people that the Civil War was fought over slavery, nothing but slavery, and who the villains were, and that slavery is wrong and it is evil. To make a show that says in 2017 that is still unresolved and that there could be that this country would never have evolved as a country with this constitutional democracy to the point where they would have decided that you couldn't have a constitution exist with slavery negates the basis for the whole country.
I think I'm confused.
Let's hear what Emmett has to say about it. We
want it to be the documentary version and not the television show version. I mean,
but it needs to follow some sense of logic.
It doesn't.
Yes, it does.
It's
because
art.
The whole idea. No. There's a level of responsibility
that
needs to be done.
We have dragons in Game of Thrones.
I think the problem that bothers me, though.
Are you concerned about the dragons?
Very much so.
I think dragons actually did exist.
Well, I do too. But the point is that we're not watching Game of Thrones to figure out.
But see, the problem with this here, and I so agree with you, Andrea, is that it's an issue.
Game of Thrones isn't based on reality, by the way.
Well, neither is this.
Yes, it is.
It's not.
Yeah.
Well, you just said it's not based on reality. When I brought up the rapes, arguing the reality of history to suggest that's what they should be depicting.
This is a what if.
This is
it's
why
gratuitous
I'm about,
sexual violence,
okay,
like all the
this
time.
Here, it's much more balanced. But my point is,
but
is
that's
that
what actually happens. That is reality.
You just said it's not reality.
Okay, this is a what if something had happened.
Yeah, but the problem
that's
is
not
this,
reality.
No.
Go
this
ahead.
Is the
you
issue
go
that
first,
bothers me that I agree with Andrea about this is that so if the South had won, Jefferson Davis is president. So are we going to? I mean, what kind of narrative strand are we following?
Watch
here?
The show.
Oh, but here's the other part that you're missing, Emmett. Seriously, we already have in this country, and vaults are still filled with it.
Thank you.
A history enshrined in film and television of the subjugation of black people.
Okay, Gone with the Wind being a classic one.
And Step and Fetch It and every single, even the black musicals like Cabin in the Sky and others,
we're taking
the ghettoizing of the
statues.
Black experience, blaxploitation movies, those things already exist and still Quentin Tarantino manages to drag that into
That's
the present.
Right.
It is not necessary to do this show to have something else to put in the vault a few years from now saying, remember that time we went back and decided that we wanted to see again what it looked like if they were slaves?
And all the Americans shut it down because they watched one episode, found it to be ludicrous, found it to be very upsetting and horrible, and they decided not
also,
to watch it
I think
and
it's
shut
also
it down.
Particularly
and
the annals of history in the
will write
and
that,
the time
and that's
that
a better
okay.
statement
than
we shut
yeah.
it down prematurely.
Okay,
no.
speaking of history, we're going to end this discussion on an upbeat note. Because I believe that all four of us have a common desire to go to a particular place. And Irene is only the only one of the four of us who, at least as of today, is fortunate
so
enough
jealous.
To have been
yeah, I,
there.
Listen,
where'd you go, Irene?
Okay, I went to the National Museum of African American History and Culture. And this is what I want to say to folks who were in the same predicament as Thea, my spouse, and I were in. We went down there with no tickets.
Okay? You are kidding me.
No, we went down there with no tickets. We did. Well, listen, we follow protocol where they say get up at 6 o'clock, 6:30 in the morning and try to get a ticket. We did not get a ticket. But let me tell for you here and all of our listeners how you can easily get a ticket.
What is it?
And not having it. That every day, there are streams. There are busloads of folks, of African-American folks. It reminds me of the March on Washington. Just busloads of church folks who come down to that museum with children in tow. You got folks that look like Miss Jane Pittman with walkers and wheelchairs. Seriously.
What's going to do with the tickets?
And well, the point is that the busload of folks, okay, these buses have tickets. You go to the buses because what happens is that invariably somebody or a lot of folks
didn't show.
That did not or missed the bus, okay? Because those buses leave on time because they are allotted to be there at a certain time. You go on the west side of the building. Ask if there are tickets, and people will give you tickets. Absolutely.
I wish you had told me that when I went down for the Women's March, because I tried to get tickets and couldn't.
No, we had no tickets every day we went down there. You go, and they'll just give them to you, and they feel blessed to do so.
Okay, now you've given us that. Can you give us like a 90-second version on what your experience was like?
Oh, absolutely, and I brought you a map.
After you snuck in.
I brought you a map, because what happens is that there are really six levels. It starts in the basement, in the bowels of the basement. It starts with slavery, and I must tell you, that's very hard. That's a very difficult one. It's at three levels here. One of the things that I sent Emmett, as a matter of fact, I sent him a picture of Harriet Tubman's shawl and Nat Turner's Bible. But I tell you what gripped me, it got me. You have the actual casket of Emmett Till. See the people processing.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
And so what happens when they take you down there, it's very, very tight. And I felt very claustrophobic, so I had to leave. I couldn't go through it. But let me tell you this: you get up on that fourth level, you see Chuck Berry's Cadillac, you see Bootsy Collum and his not only his outfit but the mothership.
Oh, I love that! I love that album.
Absolutely, you see. I mean, it's just wonderful. The Olympic awards for many of our athletes. It's a moving event, and people say that there are seven wonders in the world. Well, I can now tell you, this is the eighth wonder in the world.
How diverse generally is the crowd?
The crowd is very, very diverse here and stuff. It is absolutely amazing. It is absolutely. Oh, and let me tell you about Sweet Home Cafe here. That's like sitting at your mother's table. It is just an absolutely wonderful event.
And I think so Elijah Cummings went and listened to, you can put the headphones on and listen to the actual, and actually relived his own sit-in experience.
Oh, that's right.
And
that's
being
interactive.
And started crying.
That's right. Oh, yeah. It's interactive. Yeah. It's wonderful. And they got they have rescued or excavated a sunken slave ship. It's just absolutely wonderful experience. And I think Emmett will appreciate this. They have a wonderful religion section. So there was the money box. the money box used by Richard Allen, who was the founder of the AME Church.
Sounds fabulous. Yeah. Really sounds fabulous.
Well, now we know how to get in, we're all going to go.
Get up at 4 o'clock and sneak onto the bus or something like that. Whatever
absolutely.
It is.
Follow the bus.
On the west side.
West side of the
good
building.
To see you both.
Absolutely. It was wonderful. I leave you the map, the floor map.
Thank you kindly.
All right.
Reverends Irene Monroe and Emmett Price join us every week for All Revved Up. Irene Monroe is a syndicated religion columnist. Emmett Price is a professor of worship, church, and culture, and the founding executive director of the Institute for the Study for the Black Christian Experience at Gordon-Conwell Theological Seminary. Irene Monroe and Emmett Price, it was great to talk to you. Now, we promised you Jared Kushner's post-closed-door Capitol Hill meeting statement, and we now have it. He's out of the meeting, and here it is.
Let me be very clear. I did not collude with Russia, nor do I know of anyone else in the campaign who did so. I had no improper contacts. I have not relied on Russian funds for my businesses. And I have been fully transparent in providing all requested information. Donald Trump had a better message and ran a smarter campaign, and that is why he won. Suggesting otherwise ridicules those who voted for him.
That takes care of that.
Yeah, period. I would say the only thing you can say at the end after hearing that statement is, it's the best statement I've ever heard in my life, period.
Period.
Coming up, we're opening up the lines. We're asking you to take on a moral dilemma of the day.
A different moral dilemma, that's right.
One of Jim's favorites, Dunkin' Donuts double cupping. Mm-hmm. And if you don't know what double cupping is, stick around. We're going to go deep, deep into this ethical rabbit hole. That's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Some people see the cup half full. Others
I'm not
see the
Marjorie
cup.
Egan.
Oh, you're not Marjorie. I said it again?
Yeah, you did.
Let me start again.
Now I feel bad because I think you really wish Marjorie was here.
No, no. Oh, that is sad. That is sad. Okay. Well, she's not Marjorie Egan. She is Andrea Cabral. And I'm thrilled you're here, Andrea.
Thank you.
Okay, fine. And I'm Jim Browdy. Some people see the cup half full, as I said. Others see it half empty. And then there are those of you who see the cup doubled. You know who you are. You're the person who orders it. This drives me nuts. An iced coffee or tea. Then you ask for a styrofoam cup that's a size up so you can put your ice drink inside it. It's a practice known as the Dunkin' Double Cup, and people do it to keep their hands from getting wet and cold. Sadly, we only have a few minutes, so if you want to weigh in on this, you got to call quickly. 877-301-8970. Opening up the lines and asking you if this is an ethical breach, and the answer is it is. We've pulled out of the Paris Climate Treaty. We've seen an iceberg break away from the, whatever it's called, Larsen Ice Shelf. Al Gore is releasing a sequel to The Inconvenient Truth, while people are flagrantly doing the Dunkin' Double Cup. If you do this, why do you do it? 877-301-8970. I have to say, when I'm in line at Dunkin', and somebody orders an iced coffee, and I'm working myself into a frenzy, and ask for a styrofoam cup. And by the way, I have a problem with styrofoam. If you know me, you know that I literally will order. If styrofoam hasn't been outlawed, like in Boston hasn't been outlawed, even though I want a medium coffee at Dunkin', I will order a small because I do not allow styrofoam to touch my lips. I don't like it. I don't like the environmental impact. I don't like anything about it. It drives me out. If you have a problem holding a wet cup, I'm not yelling at you because I don't even know what your position is. If you have a problem holding the wet, cold cup, then take two napkins and hold the damn cup with napkins. But that people order the styrofoam cup, I'll stop. Dry. I'd like to rip it out of their hands. I wouldn't, but I'd like to. And I would. What's your position on
this?
Well,
this seems to be largely for the iced coffee,
Yeah, exactly.
Because you can get a cup holder for your hot. They'll put that.
It's for the ice. It's because people don't like the wet, damp, whatever kind of thing. It's ridiculous.
I personally loathe styrofoam.
Oh, just, good.
I mean, I don't like it environmentally, but it also sets my teeth on edge, like as if you were chewing foil.
Exactly.
That kind of stuff. I don't like the sound of it. But unlike you.
Yeah.
I am not driven to near homicidal rage if I see someone in front of me put it in a styrofoam.
Well, I am, sadly. Now that it really puts me over the edge because there's a suitable alternative. If it turns out they said, for example, you can't have a cup for your iced coffee, you got to put it in your hands, cup your hand, I'd say you probably need an alternative. You don't need the second cup. The double cupping is wasteful. It's environmentally tragic and all things bad.
I don't hugely disagree, but what I'll say to you is I think it's incumbent upon Dunkin' Donuts and other places to stop stocking them.
Exactly. Let's take a couple of quick calls. Julia in Boston, be quick, please, if you can. Which side are you on here?
Hey, guys. I think they should start charging for the extra cups.
Amen.
It makes you an environmental atrocity. I hate the styrofoam, too. And I can all but groan, stop myself from groaning and rolling my eyes back into my head when people do this. I hate it.
An environmental atrocity. You said it beautifully, Julia. Thank you.
Well, charging for the cup is a good idea.
It's not enough, though. I mean, of course, if you did charge, people wouldn't pay for it. So I guess it would help. Let's go to Elias and Quincy. You're on Boston Public Radio with Andrew Cabral and me, Jim Browdy. Hi.
Hey, Jim.
Hi. What's up?
I'm a long-time listener. Thanks for taking my call.
Thanks for making it. What's up?
So I completely am with you. I disagree. I think the double cup is, like, very upsetting. But I think it's already upsetting that we get new cups every time. And, like, I would rather there be a system where we bring our own reusable, our own cups from home.
Well, I don't know if Dunkin' does it. You know, a lot of places, if you bring your own cup or a reusable cup, take like 10 cents or 20 cents. So they make it, there's a financial incentive kind of thing. Elias, thank you for your call. I'm into that too. Are you an environmentalist? I don't even know. Are you
Well, I am. I mean, I do. I recycle. I do all of that other kind of stuff. And I stay away from styrofoam as much as possible. But it's sort of unavoidable.
So you never feel like grabbing the double cup out of the hands of the person in front of you and tossing it aside and giving them a stern rebuke?
Now that you've focused me on it, and it's yet another thing that I can become irrationally angry about, I may very well decide to start doing it.
Yeah, but we are in the same place. You would not drink out of a styrofoam cup, correct?
Well, no. I mean, I have been known to buy a hot coffee that is not a small from Dunkin' Donuts that
and
comes in a styrofoam
and
cup.
You're okay with it touching your lips?
I have stayed away from getting them at Dunkin' Donuts and making it at home, but I have been known to do that.
Let's go to Lou and Walpole. You're all being very quick, and that's great. Hi, Lou. Welcome.
Hey, how are you? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Long-time listener. Love Andrea.
Thank you.
Well, we're pretty fond of her here, too. Go ahead, Lou.
Hey, don't get me wrong. I love Marjorie, too.
Okay.
Thanks, Lou.
Good. We'll tell her. Go.
Anyway, two comments. Yeah. First of all, we get the styrofoam cup to keep the iced coffee cold, especially during the summertime. Pretty hot out there.
Nice try. And then, next.
Yeah. Now, secondly, I take one to work every day, and it lasts all day long.
The same styrofoam cup?
The environmental issue, I reuse the cup all the time. I don't get a new one each time I go in.
Good for you. So what do? Wash it in between?
I keep it in the car, and I stick the new cup inside the old styrofoam.
Oh, well, if you use one styrofoam once, I'm willing to make an exception for someone like you. That's actually very healthy.
You're a very benevolent leader.
No, I really am. Lou, thank you for your call, and thank you for your kind words about Andrew. You want to squeeze
one
more in?
Yes,
one
more.
Why don't you take it at the bottom of the
call? Let's talk to Kevin.
Hi, Kevin. Where are you? He's in
Somerville.
Hi, Kevin.
So my biggest issue with this is that a lot of the Dunkin' Donuts around me have done this without me even asking. They just throw it right into a styrofoam cup.
Wow. He gets automatic styrofoam.
And what do you do when that happens, Kevin?
I mean, a lot of the time there's plenty of people in line, so I sometimes just accept the styrofoam cup, and it does keep the ice colder longer. So I appreciate that, but I have taken the time to return it.
Oh, I like that. Kevin, thank you very much. It's a man of action. That's what I was looking for in a circumstance
When are we going to see a Shark Tank thing that has something that is not a styrofoam cup, that's like a cup sleeve for cold drinks, that insulates it, but it's not made of styrofoam?
Don't they have that? Isn't there like a thing that insulates the hot and, I don't know, hot and the cold?
But that you could get at Dunkin' Donuts or places like that that wouldn't cost a lot. They'd offer it to you like they offer the cardboard sleeves for the hot coffee.
You know, no one can ever say that we don't cover the big issues.
We do not.
On Boston Public Radio.
Shy away
sadly,
from the things that really mean something
not
to
really.
People.
But by the way, this does mean a lot. I think the reason you're saying you're sort of okay with it, even though you don't like it, is because you know how much it aggravates me. That is part of it. Is that true?
It's kind of a bonus. But I will tell you, I drink coffee out of your face every single morning.
Oh, you use the mug?
I literally drink coffee out of your face, too. But of course I use the mug.
You know Marjorie calls that mug? Do you know what her nickname for it is? The smug mug. Because Marjorie has this beautiful photograph on the mug, and when you turn to the side that has my photograph, and they're almost collector's items, it has this condescending, arms folded kind of horrible.
It's like getting a dose of judgment first thing
in
the morning with my
coffee.
That's
exactly what it is. Andrea, you were great. It was really fun having you. Andrea will be back tomorrow. Marjorie is back a little bit later this week. Thanks to all of you for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Please do tune in tomorrow. We're going to be at the library tomorrow, Boston Public Library. You can join us. And part of tomorrow's show is our Cinema Classic Challenge. We will be asking you with Garen Daly if Planet of the Apes, the original, still holds up. So watch it tonight. Great Cy Montgomery joins to talk about her latest book, Something About Animals. I don't know which one it is. We'll be looking at it tonight. And we've got CNN's John King. I want to thank our crew, Chelsea Murs, Amanda McGowan, Tori Bedford, Jason Tureski, Molly Boygon, Christina Biene, and sitting in for John the Claw Parker today is Bill Piacitelli. Bill, thank you, too. I'll be on Greater Boston tonight at 7 o'clock. We'll do a little politics and a couple of other things as well. We hope you tune in, and I hope you tune in again tomorrow. Again, we're at the library 11 to 2. Feel free to come by. In fact, we urge you to come by. Little Newsfeed Cafe, little us, Andrea and me, right there at Exeter and Boylston. Have a great day. See you again tomorrow at 11.